go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Thank God it's Monday. It is I think we may have a new feature here. I'm not sure. I think we may have a new feature. I'm thinking of calling this, and tell me what you think. And don't hold back. Don't be afraid of your feelings. I'm thinking of calling this Moran Monday. How do you like that? Moran Monday. I don't know if we had a really good girl singer, there might be even be a parody in the works. Who was it? The Bangles, Manic Monday. What was that? Susanna Hoffs was the lead singer or something. Have I got that right? And no, Moran Monday, just another Moran Monday. That kind of thing. And what do I mean by that? Well, I thought we would look at some Moran conduct. In this particular instance, Moran conduct coming from the for-profit media. You know, the Martini and Morphine set. That crowd of paid shills in Washington, D.C., who breathlessly have fits over things the Obama administration does, that they never somehow found a way to have fits about when the Bush administration was doing it. And, you know, it's there and it's closer to home, too. But I don't know. That seemed like it might be appropriate. Moran Monday. And, of course, I think if you're going to have a Moran Monday, You just can't do it. You simply cannot do it without dealing with Chicken Noodle News's Howie Kurtz. And in this particular instance, the breathless pearl clutching coverage of Ms. Dunn's comments about, you know, reality. The fact that Fox News is a propaganda arm of the Republican Party. It just is. How is it not? You know how I know the truth of this? Because a few minutes ago, I saw the rodeo clown, Lonesome Rhodes. There on that self-same Fox network, bloviating. And breathlessly, maybe we need a campaign to start sending pearls to Glenn Beck so that he can clutch at them. Because he took that story, and you know what I'm talking about, the one where Anita Dunn, White House Communications Director, showed up on Sunday and said, well, you know, it's not like Fox is a real news organization like CNN or anything. They're a right-wing propaganda arm of the Republican Party. Washington, inside Washington, was shocked. They were shocked. They couldn't believe that someone would say something like that. How incivil! I'm clutching for them. I don't even have pearls, and I'm clutching for my pearls here. It was breathless. It was too much to contemplate. You know what I'm talking about, of course. I'm certain that you do. You can't not. In case you're wondering, well, I can help with that. We have audio, and we also have a story breaking today about a new report coming out from, lo and behold, the insurance industry. We just got the ransom note. Really, how is this not a ransom note? We did. We just got the ransom note. If you go through with this reform thing, we're going to jack your prices up 111%. How's that? I mean, that's sort of the accounting equivalent of mailing us the tip end of somebody's finger. And seeing as how you've lost the tip end of your finger, putting that sucker back is a pre-existing condition. And you're not covered, America. You're not covered. How do you like that? Take that. Yeah, don't fool with us. Yeah. Now, a report came out today. Now, never mind the fact that the methodology is extremely spotty. And not exactly anything you would call a methodology at all. But Representative Anthony Winder of New York got it right on the first try. He looked at this report, and he said, you know, if you have the healthcare industry complaining that we're going to raise costs because of these charges, it is them putting us on notice that we haven't put enough cost containment in the bill. You know, the healthcare industry themselves is putting out a whole report saying that. That should be a tell to the Baucus team that, you know what, maybe it's time for them to go back and revisit the public option. In a strange way, and look, obviously they didn't mean this, the health insurance lobby today fired the most important salvo in weeks for the public option because they've said, as clear as day, left to their own devices, according to their own number crunchers, they're going to raise rates 111%. You know, I think if healthcare was run by the mob, we'd probably have a little bit better business dealings here. Just saying. Oh, and by the way, this story about this that I'm looking at, and I know I'm commenting on a photograph now. This is the dancing about architecture part of the program. But I'm looking at a photograph of Karen Ignani. I got a figure in its native Italian. It's got to be Ignani. But it reads Ignagni. I'm looking at a photograph over here, and she looks like she had plastic surgery done after having been treated with the Jack Nicholson Joker's Smilex. Ooh, honey, I don't want to walk in the door and have you smiling at me. Ooh. Sorry, sexism on parade. My bad. That's okay. Agnes will spank me later. No, not like that. She will chastise me. She will chastise me for my overt sexism, and I apologize. But that's one ugly woman. But anyway, to get back to the martini and morphine crowd, the M&M crowd, they were terribly breathless over this simple comment over the weekend. Sunday morning on CNN's Reliable Sources with... with how in God's name did he ever get on television, Howie Kurtz. It helps to have a wife who's big in the PR lobbying business. It really, really is. No, this is White House Communications Director Anita Dunn speaking plain and simple facts.
We're talking about conservative commentators, so let's talk about Fox News.
Yeah.
You were quoted this week in Time magazine as saying of Fox News, it's opinion journalism masquerading as news. What do you mean masquerading?
Well, you know, Howie, I think if we went back a year ago to the fall of 2008, to the campaign, that, you know, it was a time this country was in two wars, that we'd had a financial collapse, probably more significant than any financial collapse since the Great Depression. If you were a Fox News viewer in the fall election, what you would have seen would have been that the biggest stories and biggest threats facing America were a guy named Bill Ayers and something called Acorn. I mean, the reality of it is that Fox News often operates almost as either the research arm or the communications arm of the Republican Party. And it's not ideological. I mean, obviously, there are many commentators who are conservative, liberal, centrist, and everybody understands that. What I think is fair to say about Fox, and certainly the way we view it, is that it really is more a wing of the Republican Party.
Okay, just a minute. Let's work through this real quick. That's a healthy little 1 minute and six second sized chunk of sound to get through. Is there anybody out here who doesn't think Fox is an arm of the Republican Party? Has a story ever aired on Fox News that did not somehow or another advance the Republican agenda? Now, see, compare. I know. We're comparing ants with elephants, and I'm the ant here. I make no bones about the fact that I don't like Republicans. Not even a little bit. Republicans who see the light and come in from the cold and enter, disavow the dark side. Okay, we can talk. But your average garden variety, I swear at Obama, he's a black Muslim socialist Republican. No, I don't like him. Don't want anything to do with him. Wouldn't have him to dinner. But why is this a surprise? It's only a surprise to the pathologically self-deluded. And by that, of course, I mean the for-profit media. I mean, you can't talk that way. It's just not nice. You're a Democrat. You're supposed to stand there and let them spit on you and kick you and stomp your feet and kidney punch you while you sit there and sing Kumbaya. That's how this system works. You are upsetting the apple cart, Ms. Dunn. I simply cannot believe you would say what you said. But moreover, I'm wondering if Anita Dunn has pressing business or a job offer somewhere that pays a lot more money. Because she put the Fox News crosshairs on herself on Sunday, and it's been proven ever since. I mean, and see, this is the only, your White House communications director, give me a call, Anita. Because I'll explain you something. And it's not something I came up with. I'm just passing on generational wisdom. Because there is an old saying out there in political circles that you do not start a war, you cannot win a war. So do not start a war, and this goes, it's an old newspaper analogy, okay, so we'll have to translate it to television later. But you do not start a war because you cannot win a war with somebody who buys ink by the barrel. Because they will beat you to pieces. And that's all Fox. I just checked in a couple of times. Everything since the story broke yesterday, I've just over to Fox for a couple of minutes, and I could hear the brain cells screaming and dying. But just to check in once in a while, and lo and behold, there it was. Click, click, click. White House says it's at war with Fox News. Click. The war on Fox News. More in a minute. Have you bought any gold lately? Click. And all the way up to the starting of Lonesome Rhodes' program about an hour ago now. And you got to love what he got out of it. I don't have any way to capture it. We're working on that. Trust me, we're working. Right now we're just trying to keep the lights on, you understand. Oh, he had to explain to his knuckle-walking, toe-sucking, toenail-chewing viewership, mouth breathers that they are. He had to explain to them that he did not hold himself out as a journalist. This is the old I'm just an entertainer shtick. He said, this is an opinion program, and we always get our facts straight. Yeah. But the reason I ask is the crosshairs are obviously on Anita Dunn. Oh, by the way, where did Lonesome Rhodes take it? The rodeo clown. He said, Well, you know this says a lot more about you than it does about Fox News, right? The Obama White House just said you're stupid. They did. Shh. They really, really did. They're not talking about Fox News. They're talking about the people who watch Fox News. This is an insult to the people who watch Fox News, not an insult to Fox News. God, I haven't seen that tactic since, third grade? On that sort of hard-baked old red-orange dirt playground of the elementary school back in Florence, Alabama? Yeah. You know, where the perennial troublemaker runs up to some, usually the most beautiful little girl in second grade and says, "He said you're ugly." And she tears up and cries, and the teacher comes over, "Johnny said I'm ugly." "Really? When did he say it to you?" "Well, Glenn told me." "Glenn, did you tell her that Johnny said she was ugly?" "Well, I'm just an opinion second grader. That's my opinion. I do opinion stuff. It's my opinion that Johnny thinks she's ugly." "Well, did Johnny ever say it?" "No. But it's my opinion." "You know what? You know, Mrs. Krabappel, you know what this, you know, this says more about you than it does about me." And again, just because the keeping the lights on here has been so much on my mind, there's millions of dollars in that crap. Millions of dollars! Oh! But let's continue with Anita Dunn. That almost sounds like a joke name. If her name... She spent her life making sure she did not marry a man named Goodman. Let's put it that way.
Is that the reason
that the president did not go on Fox News Sunday a few weeks back when he did all the other Sunday shows? And will President Obama appear on Fox News again, let's say, this year?
Well, you know, Howie, President Obama appeared on, he did The Factor, and he did O'Reilly.
Yes.
In the campaign last year. As president earlier this year, when he met with news anchors.
Okay, my question
Chris
is,
Wallace.
Will he appear on Fox in the next couple of months?
No, you had a two-part question. The first was, is this why he did not appear? And the answer is, yes. Obviously, he'll go on Fox because he engages with ideological opponents, and he has done that before. He will do it again. I can't give you a date because, frankly, I can't give you dates for anybody else right now. But what I will say is that when he goes on Fox, he understands he's not going on it really as a news network at this point. He's going on to debate the opposition, and that's fine. He never minds doing that. But let's be realistic here, Howie. You know, they're widely viewed as, you know, a part of the Republican Party. Take their talking points, put them on the air. Take their opposition research, put them on the air, and that's fine. But let's not pretend they're a news network the way CNN is.
Trying to curry a little favor there with the chicken noodle news guy. Because that was just... Surprise? But still, I got to wonder if she's maybe found a better job or something. Because she's going to get Van Jones now. I see no reason why she wouldn't be. She's going to get... she's going to get Yoshi Sargented. She's going to get done to her what is already being done to Kevin Jennings. And Anne-Marie Cox is at Air America Radio. And she showed up to talk with Howie Kurtz this weekend as well. And bless her heart for at least noting the Kevin Jennings story. Kurtz was trying to manage as best he could the conversation and didn't want anything to do with the story. But Anne-Marie Cox did get a mention out there, and it deserves a mention.
There's a sort of a scam going on there in terms of, like, registering people
to
get paid to register. And I'm sorry, I have to say something about this Jennings story because I think it's really offensive. They're persecuting someone because he's gay.
We don't have time to go through each controversy right now, but did Fox have the same appetite for stories that reflected poorly on the Bush administration?
Probably not. Yeah, definitely not. Of course, my underwear comes from Kmart. But that's unfair because that guy's from West Virginia anyway. But the Kevin Jennings thing, yeah, there is a full-on smear campaign by the right wing against Kevin Jennings. And I remember when they ran Van Jones off, I said, well, they went after the black guy. And everything indicated that next up would be the Jewish guy. But I forgot that there was a gay guy out there to hate on. And Kevin Jennings is gay. Kevin Jennings is also extremely competent. Kevin Jennings is also committed to making sure that little kids don't have their guts stomped out on playgrounds while ignorant mouth-breathing knuckle-dragging children of ignorant knuckle-dragging mouth-breathing parents scream, "Faggot!" and gut stomp them some more. So naturally, the right wing, including Fox, are full on after Kevin Jennings. Oh, and by the way, you know how Howie said he didn't have time to go into the rampant homophobia that just oozes like filth out of the right wing sewer in the Republican Party. Oddly enough, as Heather has noted over at Crooks and Liars, later in the same program, Howie Kurtz did find the time to talk about President Obama, the reaction, not about President Obama getting the Nobel Prize, but the reaction to it by the right wing, you know, the bloviating, the pearl clutching, the breathless gasping. And he also found time to talk about the David Letterman sex scandal. But he didn't have time to talk about a perfectly competent, perfectly decent, upstanding human being smeared over his sexuality. Nope, no time for that in the martinis and morphine set. No time. So that's just a quick look at the weirdos from the weekend. More and Monday. Oh well, wait a minute, wait. Okay, just as a counterpoint, there's this, William the Bloody Crystal, who still manages to find his way onto Fox, you know, professionally wrong guy William the Bloody Crystal, who is mad because we haven't killed quite enough people, haven't gotten quite enough Americans dead in Afghanistan yet. This is interesting.
Bill, the White House says the president has made no decision yet, but officials seem to be outlining what seems to be the general shape of what they're looking at, and that is that it's enough to weaken the Taliban in Afghanistan, but not to eliminate it, and that won't require a major increase in U.S. troops. First, do you think that's where they're headed, and do you think that'll work?
I mean, it sounds as if that's where some of them want to be headed. I actually would be amazed if the president signs off on that. I mean, as commander-in-chief, he's going to tell U.S. forces over there, we're weakening your enemy a little less than we could if we actually did what the commanding general asks. But, you know, go ahead and fight against an enemy that's stronger.
A, it isn't what has been said. B, he's a filthy liar. But who the hell am I?
Because I'm reluctant to send enough troops, and why? I mean, that's what's crazy. He's taken withdrawing troops off the table. He's not going to pull out of Afghanistan. There is a respectable left-wing argument for that, right-wing argument for that, but he's not doing that. He's taken pure counterterrorism off the table. We're not going to go offshore and just use drones. So we're fighting a counterinsurgency. He called it an insurgency less than 2 months ago, what we're fighting. So we're fighting counterinsurgency. The general who's in charge of fighting the counterinsurgency says we can do this with the best effect. We have the best chance of winning. We're going to make the most progress. We'll have the fewest casualties for the U.S. if we adequately resource this counterinsurgency. I don't really see what's the rationale then for saying, well, you know, that's a good point, General McChrystal, but I'm going to fight a counterinsurgency. We're just going to do it in a half-hearted way.
But what, no,
so I
just,
don't think. Well, so I think at the end he might surprise us and go with General McChrystal's recommendation. I just don't see what the rationale for not taking it is once you've agreed that we're fighting a counterinsurgency.
But Bill, it's not just 40,000 or bus.
Well, actually, wait. It now turns out this week
right.
that the top request that was made was 60,000. 40,000 turns out to be the preferred middle option.
Options on the board coming from General McChrystal, but the way that it's being presented here is, oh, you got to give General McChrystal all the answer. And don't forget, President Obama gave him 21,000 already this year. So the question is, where are we going? And what we've seen, if you look at the projections, is as we increase troop levels, we have more and more casualties. It's not that suddenly additional force means...
And by the way, this is Juan Williams who threw away his credibility, years of credibility generated at National Public Radio, but never mind.
That we are additionally in command. So what we've seen in the past week is intense fighting in Pakistan. We see as the Pakistani government tries to do more to restrain al-Qaeda.
You know, I got to tell you, I'm watching video here, and just the look on William the Bloody Crystal's face when the black guy is talking to him like an equal. I mean, his neck gets stiff and the little muscles come out. How dare you!
Which is the real problem. We don't want the Taliban getting a secure base in Afghanistan because we don't want them to be a host for al-Qaeda. So if, in fact, the real fight is in Pakistan, why don't we just make sure that, for example, the Pakistanis are stable enough to keep the Taliban at bay and then go after al-Qaeda?
I know there are political pressures, but I would like to think that this president, I do think that this...
By the way, the real nugget's coming. Just hang tight.
This president is trying to make the right decision. There is no guarantee if you give McChrystal the 60,000 troops, that it's going to work.
Particularly
given the nature of the government that is in control in Afghanistan now.
But what is better about giving him, quote, giving him? I like that. Why do we use that formulation? The president is sending as many troops as he thinks, as he should send as many troops as he thinks best to accomplish the mission, unless he wants to abandon the mission. But he doesn't want to abandon the mission. What argument?
Why doesn't he want to abandon the mission? Now, we still haven't gotten to the nugget yet. But why doesn't he want to abandon the mission? It's obviously a failure, and that's no reflection on the people fighting it. We're fighting an unwinnable war. The White House knows it. The brass knows it. Everybody knows it. Except William the Bloody Crystal. And Fox News, which, see above, is nothing but a propaganda organ for the Republican Party. But everybody knows! I do love being ahead of the curve. I love the fact that the horn is out there ahead of the curve. We figured it out a long time ago. Alexander couldn't do it. The Russians couldn't do it. The British couldn't do it. The Russians couldn't do it again. Even the Persians, who kind of live, the Medes and the Persians, who kind of live close to it, couldn't do it. Can't be done. Cranky Hill people. We've had that conversation. But... no, he's not going to abandon the mission. Don't know why. But notice the use of the language. Abandon the mission. Where I come from, we call that wising up. Oh, he wised up to the fact that hitting himself in the thumb with a hammer really sucked and he really ought to not do it the 15th time after doing it the first 14. But, pay attention to the use of language. Abandon the mission. Well, if he abandons the mission, consider the implications. Abandon the mission. What they're trying to say is abandon the troops. Yeah, we're just going to not send them any more food or gasoline or nothing. They're just going to sit there and get picked off one by one by them Taliban sharpshooters and IED makers. And pretty soon there won't be any Americans left because they're abandoning the mission. Because they abandoned troops. Support the troops. Have you bought, that Chinese magnet on the back of your SUV is looking a little bit faded. About time you went down to the local Wally World and bought yourself a brand shiny new Chinese yellow ribbon magnet, isn't it? Time to support the troops. Yeesh. But like I said, we haven't gotten to the good part yet. We haven't gotten to the nugget yet. It's coming. It's still on the way.
What grown-up serious argument is there that sending 15,000...
Okay, back this up just a second, because there's the nugget.
For example, the Pakistanis are stable enough to keep the Taliban at bay and then go after al-Qaeda.
I know there are political pressures, but I would like to think that this president, I do think that this president is trying to make the right decision. There is no guarantee if you give McChrystal the 60,000 troops, that it's going to work. Particularly given the nature of the government that is in control in Afghanistan now.
But what is better about giving him, quote, giving him? I like that. Why do we use that formulation? The president is sending as many troops as he thinks, as he should send as many troops as he thinks best to accomplish the mission, unless he wants to abandon the mission. But he doesn't want to abandon the mission. What argument, what grown-up serious argument is there that sending 15,000 troops is going to be better than sending 40,000 troops when General McChrystal and General Petraeus think 40,000 is what you need to adequately resource the counterinsurgency? Maybe we shouldn't send too many bullets.
See? Maybe we shouldn't send too many bullets. Jiminy Christmas, this is sickening.
Either. We shouldn't send too many vehicles. It's very expensive. I mean, this notion that we're going to have more casualties is ridiculous, Juan. Short term, of course, if you engage the enemy, you might have more casualties. Ask any soldier or Marine over there, would you prefer to have 110,000 of you or 70,000 of you? That we are stretched too thin, if you read the accounts of the recent battles. If we're going to fight,
Bill, just asking, you know, because I'm crazy that way. But are any of your kith and kin over there, Bill? You talk about this so academically, what grown-up? I tell you what, screw the grown-ups. Let's talk about the kinfolk. What kinfolk serious argument is there to sending 15,000 troops is any better than 40,000, Bill? Because you know what? The kinfolk argument is don't send no more and bring them all home to their kith and kin and their warm, loving arms and hearths and homes. That's the argument, Bill. Because, and this is purely academic at this, I'm just going to try to be academic, like I don't care about anybody that's over there, even though I know folks who are. And care about folks who are. Here's the real argument. If you're going to take Afghanistan, the only way to do it, is the only way that there was to take Iraq. And that's to send in an army of 500,000 to 1,000,000. And then displace the population. Scatter it. I mean, look, ancient history is full of this stuff. The Bible's full of it. You either kill everybody that's there and replace the population, like happens in the Old Testament, you know, and yea, verily, God did say, kill them all! Women, children, dogs, cats, beasts of the field, kill them all, saith the Lord God. There's that. Or there's conquer the place and scatter everybody, which is what later got done to the people who said God told them to kill them all. You could argue that the scattering is more humane than the kill them all part. But those are the only two options. Kill them all, or take the place, and everybody who lives there, send them somewhere else, preferably not near a whole lot of other people. Right. You know, with today being Columbus Day and all, it's sort of hard to get around noting that when white Europeans first saw people living on this continent, many of whom were already dying off because of the advancing march of disease, they started trying to figure out and they started trying to figure out where are all these Indians coming from. You know, the great Custer quote. Custer's last words, where are all these GD Indians coming from? They tried to figure it out because, see, they had their holy book, their Bible, and it told them that, well, hell, they didn't even know that continent was there. And look what they had to do to get there. You know, sailing ships and months at sea and all of that. And all of a sudden there's all these people and they got these civilizations and these gleaming cities. Flush toilets. Which, by the way, the Spanish were absolutely baffled by. Bathing! but they had to figure out where they came from. And so, naturally, instead of using reason, common sense, rationality, they went to the Bible. And being as how there was an account somewhere in second, one of those stupid books, about the 12 tribes of Israel getting scattered by the Assyrians, the Syrians, the Akkadians, the Babylonians, or, you know, God knows who. And they got scattered and were never heard from again. Well, what did they think? Oh, well, granted, they don't look much like, no, they don't look like Arabs or Jews or us. Or, they don't look like anybody we've ever run across. They're lost Jews! That's what they are. They're the lost tribes of Israel. There, we got it. No. But that's because they made an assumption that everybody was created 6,000 years ago out of Adam and Eve, and then they had Cain and Abel, and Cain and Abel apparently got it on with Eve. And you got to think about it. If Genesis is correct, then we should all have big ears and buggy eyes. But never mind. You know, because of Cain and Abel doing mom. Uncle Daddy! But anyway, so that's our Columbus Day moment. Maybe we'll have some more Columbus Day moments. But there's only one way. There's only one way to pacify a region. And, you know, here's a hint. One of those ways is not to bomb the snot out of people, hellfire missile their weddings, kill their women and children, and then come in and say, hey, but look, we drilled a well. Doesn't work. This doesn't work so good. And yet, Bill Kristol can't seem to figure that out. I find it astonishing.
Let's fight the war. So you explain to them, Bill Kristol, explain to their parents, why are they there? They should be there because they are fighting for a stable government that's going to be able to withstand the incursions coming from the Taliban and ultimately Al-Qaeda. And if we don't have a clear sense of that mission, then I don't think you can say to the parents,
then we should get out.
Child.
We should get out.
But
no,
you tell the parents we're fighting it in a half-assed way. No, you can't. No, but don't you think we have... I'm sorry, go right ahead. Go ahead.
We're not committed to doing what it takes to win. We've got a clear sense of the mission, but we're going to only... 50%
I don't see why
you
would think that. Why is anybody thinking that we want to weaken American forces? We are American forces, and I don't think the president has been anything but committed.
Well, panel, thank you. I'm glad we settled this.
Oh, boy, I tell you what. You know, I can't believe that I get that I get cranky emails for watching the NFL on Sunday instead of that. Although there's plenty to gripe about inside the NFL that I'll try not to do this evening. But, you know, there you go. Giving a platform to William Kristol, who does not have the same the success rate as a stopped clock. You know the old saying, even a stopped clock is right twice a day. Bill Kristol doesn't have that. Bill Kristol gets up in the morning and says, good night, sweetheart. He's that wrong all the time. What would you like for breakfast, dear? I'll have the Drano. Really? The guy is an idiot. Now, that's not to say the guy hasn't been to school. He's obviously had some schooling. But he is what Calvin Coolidge once referred to as an educated derelict. An educated derelict. So there you have it. The conversation this weekend centered around a comment by Anita Dunn about what piss-poor journalism Fox News does in terms of, you know, unbiased journalism. While the real story it turns out. And granted, I guess it kind of broke today, but you know how it is with the for-profit media. They get a heads up. Of course they get a heads up. And the heads up is this report out from the insurance industry saying that they will jack rates up if we dare to try to put some sort of responsibility onto the for-profit, avarice-driven healthcare industry. If we dare to do that, they have told us straight up that they will jack the rates 111%. You can't get any more direct. You can't get any more out front than that. That is the act. That's the act of an absolutely hubris-driven corporate scheme, telling us that we're getting just a little too uppity for their likings. You know, I had an email from my buddy David in Tennessee. Sent along a tune. Going to run it in a minute because it fits so perfect. And I did not have a heads up that this story would break, but it all, as is so often the case on this program, everything comes together so amazingly. And David said, as I watch the kabuki theater that is our government, the House and the Senate and the President, dancing all around doing anything meaningful, I have these flights of fancy. May we please move even further beyond Alan Grayson and for once effing do something, please? Right now in my life may be the last time holds a special fascination. I'm at that stage within my time upon the stage, don't you know? I have a better, deeper understanding of mortality these days. So I'm thinking, whenever the Bob rails against the Dems that are sitting on the bills that could save 122 citizens a day, maybe we should couch our conditional support in the guise of, hey, effer, this could be the last time. Then the Bob could spin the prophetic platter from Mick and the boys that does, in my humble opinion, transcend the time of its origin. Yeah. Yeah, that's two for two, Friday and Monday, that David has hit one right out of the park. Big old hanging curveball. Anything leaves the park that fast needs a stewardess on it. Because it's the truth. And it's the one truth that with the exception of Congressman Grayson, isn't being driven home. This is not an academic discussion. This is not some sort of philosophical debate. Healthcare has the reality and the real lives of some, at a minimum, 40 to 45,000 Americans per year riding on it. And just by way of comparison, let me ask, where would we be as liberals if 45,000 Americans had died in Iraq every year since George Bush started that ill-advised nightmare in the sand? Would we still have forgotten it even though we've got a Democrat in the White House, or because we've got a Democrat in the White House now and we don't want to remind too many people, you know, shh, it's his war now. What were the numbers out of Vietnam? 55,000 dead and counting? And we were in Vietnam how long? 15, 16, 17 years? $10,000 shy of Vietnam die every year. Not because of disease. Not cancer, not heart attack, not stroke. Not COPD, not Alzheimer's. But simply because they can't go to the doctor. Because they can't afford it. Those are the realities. The other reality is that the last time we talked about this was 1993. 16 years ago. And then it went away. With the exception of the lone voice of folks like Dennis Kucinich crying in the wilderness, it went away. And every one of those years, 45,000 Americans died because the Congress didn't give a rat's ass. Because it was more fun to, impeach a president for a consensual sex act. Because it was more fun to debate whether or not Saddam Hussein is a brutal dictator who gassed his own people. I'm at the end of my tolerance for that calculus. I'm at the end of my willingness to put up with that kind of BS. That kind of political BS. That kind of politics played with innocent lives. Again, not dead because they were too fat, not dead because they smoked, not dead because of any overt reason except for the fact that we have a healthcare system that instead of treating people, keeps them from getting treatment. God damn. That's astonishing. Holy Moses. What happens to somebody's brain in Washington, D.C. that makes that acceptable? And yes, I understand that there's a caveat that there's a lot of people, more in the certainly in the Democratic Party, none in the Republican, who have been concerned about this all along. That's why I referred to Dennis Kucinich's time in the wilderness. To his credit, Senator Rockefeller has long championed health care reform. I profoundly disagree with my congressman on issues of the coal extraction in the state that contributes to those illnesses. But it's been on his plate, too. And for a 12-year wander in the wilderness, not a damn thing could be done about it because Newt Gingrich had the Congress and the American people by their damn throats. And under George W. Bush, when they did get around to doing something, it was, as this bill, as the current Kabuki Theater, as David refers to it, turns out to be, wound up being a plum for the industry and not a damn thing for the American people in the form of the Medicare Part D, the prescription drug Medicare plan. It does less for our seniors than it does for Big Pharma. And the industry, because there's administration. Meanwhile, this so-called debate is taking place within defined terms, whereby we think, if we can get a trigger, what we can do is we can leave the avarice-driven healthcare industry alone, but we'll put a trigger in, and if they don't meet our standards, we'll pull that trigger. We will. Don't press us. And then we'll pull the trigger and there'll be a public option. And all of that stuff happens in 2013. So that means that the debate about the universal single-payer Medicare for all won't happen till 2020, 2025, 2030. Jesus! What that ultimately means, and pay attention to this, I'm talking to, you know, young to old, what that effectively means is it will not be discussed again until everybody listening to this program is dead! Goddamn! You know, the way that the generation of the children of Israel wandering in the desert had to wander until they were dead because they sinned against God, and only the newbies could enter into the kingdom of the promised land and the milk and the honey and with frisbees and wheat checks and all that stuff. We're not just talking about 45,000 people a year. We are talking about a death sentence on an entire collection of generations. Forget about Generation X or Generation Y or baby boomers. You're all the dead generations. Because that is ultimately the goal of the healthcare industry, to make sure that we are all dead before they are. Because they see this as an ultimate struggle for the very survival of the insurance industry. And the survival of the insurance industry is more important than your survival. And I'll be goddamned if I can figure out why it isn't being framed that way. Wow, that's three GDs in a hand. Wow. Why that hasn't been explained very patiently on the floor of the House or the Senate. It is us against them in the purest sense of the word. If they live, you die. If we win this thing, then the only thing happens is that some no-good, blood-sucking CEOs are out of work. Everybody else still has a job. So really, no kidding. This is not a drill. This is not a joke. This is it. There's one. One chance.
There can be only one.
Was it F. Scott Fitzgerald or Thomas Wolfe or somebody who said there's no second act in American life? So too with this issue. There's no second act. Maybe this is a one-act play. And when the curtain rings down, it's going to be curtains for the insurance industry, or, and this means a hell of a lot more to me, it's going to be curtains for you. Am I telling you something to do? No, I'm not telling you something to do. I'm merely trying to point out the dynamics of the situation. You act accordingly. Because there's no second chance. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Well, I've told you once and I've told you twice, but you never listen to my advice. You don't try very hard to please me, but what you know, it should be easy. Well, this could be
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Guilty as charged. I let the intro run a little bit long because I was finishing some emails. I have to multitask here. I'd forgotten to get into the chat room. Bad host. Bad. Oh, well. That's what makes this so much different from just about any other version of so-called talk radio out there. Multitasking. It's the way of the future. It's the next big thing. It's like indoor plumbing. And by the way, don't let me forget that there's a follow-up story to it, a couple of follow-up stories to what we were talking about in the last, with the healthcare business. One of which includes the muzzling of a senior statesman of the Republican Party, if you can imagine. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hey, Susan.
I got a couple of little tidbits for you. First of all, it seems that among the other fun and games we've got going today is prosecutors are according to the AP, prosecutors are investigating claims that a former chef and chief groundskeeper of the Oklahoma governor's mansion have raped female prison inmates assigned to work on the museum grounds.
Oh, Jesus.
You know, on the mansion grounds, I mean. You know, just leave it to Oklahoma.
Well, it's not surprising because, you know, that's the heart of the punishment fetish culture. And, you know, once, you know, no matter why she's in there for a reason, and that means that she's there for to be used.
Right. Now, and this kind of folds directly into it. I put up a thing on the main page under the featured section, and it's entitled, you're going to love the title, Ayn Rand, Murder Groupie.
Oh, I know. Sick, isn't it?
Yeah. For those who haven't read it yet, there is an article, part of an article there, linked there. It's from Open Left, and it turns out that Rand's most famous piece of schlock, otherwise known as Atlas Shrugged, her hero character, John Galt, was based on a real person, a man named William Hickman. Now, William Hickman was a real piece of work.
Oh, yeah, he was psycho.
William Edward Hickman. He was a sociopath. And that's one of the reasons why she liked him, because he was a sociopath.
Because everything she describes in her,
her diaries, yeah.
No. But there's a phrase for it. Enlightened selfishness, or you know, some such miserable. Basically, the philosophy of Ayn Rand, as it's laid out in Atlas Shrugged and those other pieces of Dreck, is sociopathic behavior.
Yeah, and this guy, he was put to death for kidnapping and killing a young girl. And oh man, the points on that crime alone are—it's a good thing they did put him to death. But she went right down to the wire for this man. She thought it was horrendous that he was put to death, because she said she felt that if he needed to do this, well, then he should have been allowed to do it.
Of course.
And this is the type of bedrock that philosophy sits on. Deep.
Twisted, isn't it?
Dr. Rick, write her to sign phone, please. Dr. Rick.
Oh yeah, I hope you email that and the Oklahoma story to Rick, because he will. It's like buttering his bread.
Well, I emailed him the Ayn Rand story a couple days ago. I haven't had a chance to send him the Oklahoma story, but I will. My other point was in regard to the health care thing. We all knew what the insurance companies were going to do. How could you not know?
Yeah. How could you not?
Let's lay this out
real plain, Susan. If the Baucus thing gets turned into law, it will be nothing short of legalized extortion from the American people.
Well, I was thinking more on the lines of legalized rape. Because it'll be a case of bend over, people, here it comes again. And you get to pay for the privilege, too.
I know.
Yeah, that would be like... that would be like Martin Luther King walking up to his own assassin and say, here's some money and a gun, shoot me.
Yeah, bullets.
Yeah. It's just, you know, anybody who believes that these insurance companies were going to get on the bandwagon believed in the tooth fairy.
Yeah, but meanwhile, out in Arkansas, there's a miserable little ad running saying, call Blanche Lincoln and thank her for opposing the public option and standing up for working families in Arkansas.
Oh, I could say something.
You know, that it really is. It's that Orwellian stuff that got referred to Friday night. You know, freedom is slavery, hope is despair, war is peace.
Convincing the serfs that they're lords, basically.
Yeah.
All the while slipping them the the chain around their neck. There's another article up on the web that some organization is calling the latest student loan deals modern indentured servitude.
Oh yeah, that's why I used to make that joke that if only we could prove that Osama bin Laden had a student loan, we could find him yesterday.
Oh yeah, we could nail him tomorrow.
Because the student loan people can find anybody.
Oh yeah.
What a buddy of mine used to refer to as the student loan secret police.
Right. The just to show you how absolutely obnoxious they are. Health insurance company denied health care to a four-month-old baby for a pre-existing condition. His condition, they say he's obese. What is he eating? He's nursing.
Yeah, they missed that whole chubby, happy baby thing. Of course, now they're covering. Now they're covering.
Oh, yeah. Now, since it hit the web and it ended up on television and everything like that, now they're walking back real fast. But how many babies have they turned down?
That's the thing. For every time an avarice-driven insurance company gets caught, how many times did they not? It's like catching a burglar. Yeah, you got him with the silver over there in that house, but how many houses has he not been caught in? And there's by extension of the analogy, Susan, there's got to be some sort of public will toward trying to find out how many other burglaries there are.
Mm-hmm. I did when the insurance companies came out with that threat to up the rates, I did like the statement that came out immediately afterwards.
Who's?
Anthony Weiner.
Okay.
He came out. He said that's the best excuse for the public option that exists in creation, right there.
Yeah, I had that right at the top of the show as we were discussing it. Only maybe there was a misprint in it. Maybe they added an extra D. It was they had it spelled Weinder, but go figure. Yeah, it's the internet.
Yeah,
burned again.
Yeah, it's just you have to take it as you get it. I don't. As far as the comebacks going, as far as verbal comebacks, I think that has to go to an anonymous post. Liz Cheney made the comment that Obama should send a woman who lost her son to the in war to pick up the Peace Prize. In the name of all of the fallen soldiers.
Somebody now that's Orwellian.
Yeah, like Cindy Sheehan.
Oh, it would be lovely if he broke it off in her that way. But then Cindy'd say, "No, I won't go and pick it up because Barack Obama's a warmonger." And then we'd be there.
Just the comeback was just priceless.
Oh, it is. And I mean no disrespect to Cindy Sheehan out of that. It's just,
Oh, yeah.
Cindy doesn't give a rat's ass about politics. She cares about ending war. And so, Democrat, Republican, anarcho-syndicalist, it doesn't matter. If you're not ending a war but maintaining one, get them pass.
Yep. Exactly.
And frankly, I think that's a perfectly reasonable and rational approach.
It doesn't bother me any. My idea about Afghanistan is just leave quickly.
Doesn't make any sense to stay.
Yeah.
Anyway, not that I can figure out.
Yeah, I can't.
And I'm glad you did let me know about the turned down baby, because I've got the press release, the follow up press release. Now that they have decided to cover said infant, And I think that probably bears a few minutes of going, you know, just a little journalistic fine-tooth combing. Because it's something. I've read it. It is truly a piece of work.
Well, I'll let you get to it then.
All right, Susan, you take care.
Okie doke.
All right.
You Los Angeles.
All right, bye-bye. News Ninja Susan calling from Columbia City, Oregon, and onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Kevin from Brooklyn.
Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Oh, boy, you know, it's becoming exhausting the length they will go. You know, there comes a point where you have to just say, I at this point, there's no arguing with them. Just beat them to a pulp.
In this case, who are them?
The right wing, the sociopaths, the Calvinists, you know, those people, that bunch. Because really, you cannot reason with them. There is no reason. And I think, even though I didn't agree with him politically on a lot of stances, but when you look back to Churchill, he was absolutely right when it came on to Hitler.
Well, sure he was. He made his career out of being right about Hitler.
Okay, because in many ways, Churchill is the right-wing sociopath himself, and it takes one to know him.
Well, I don't know that he was a right-wing sociopath, because at one point he was left, at another point he was right. But what he was a political opportunist, and he was also, there's no getting around, a profound racist and a nasty bigot.
But
he was also a man of his age. I mean, William Manchester, who wrote the biography American Caesar of MacArthur, also started on a biography of Churchill that I don't think he finished because he died. But he referred to him as the last lion because he really was. Churchill was the last Victorian statesman in the British Empire.
Oh, absolutely, and he believed in the British Empire. That was his state, the British Empire. After all, the empire was very good to him, going back to Duke of Marlborough. He said that was just a good trouble.
Right, and he was fascinated with his history as such.
Yeah, it's just that he saw there was no reasoning, and I think Barack Obama is, in our day, what's the prime minister who was the appeaser again? He escapes me. I should know this.
Oh, Neville Chamberlain?
Yes. Okay. It comes a point where you have to say, you know what? F these people. No. And I think he just... And this is why I said I really hope this is the biggest political rope-a-dope ever. Because to show that... And he's going to come out and strike in November sometime and say, look, there's no appeasing, executive order or whatever, boom, Medicare for all kind of thing.
Well, I don't think it'll happen on a Medicare for all basis. I don't think it can happen on an executive order basis. It has to be legislated. But I'm with you. I'm in that corner. I hope he's. It's just hard to do after a while to sit there and wow, you know what it is. He's a great chess player and he's six moves ahead of everybody. He may be, but right now it just looks like he is trying to build consensus. But maybe this instead of just coming out all in your face and ham-fisted and saying it's my way or the highway because Lord knows that's how the Bush administration did it. Maybe by saying, look, we tried, we reached across the aisle, we literally spent 6 months and let 23,000 Americans die for want of health care in our attempt to get even one Republican to sign on for what America needs. Enough is enough, and send some sort of a signal that it's time to do, at the very minimum, a public option.
And the thing is, have to look at the subtle racism. And, you know, no offense to you, Bob, but I don't think you can. Believe you me, you do a good job. And
no, I can't. Look, I'm so pink, I sunburn under the refrigerator light bulb. I know I can't.
Okay, and that's why I appreciate men like you and Mike and Guy, is because you have to understand, yes, he's a black man, and one thing I know, being as such, you better have all your I's dotted and your T's crossed and your commas in the right place with a power move.
Oh, I don't doubt that a dime's worth, Kevin. Let me say that if I have any ability that I may have to comprehend that issue comes from just the, you know, not even 0.1% of what real racism is, but I at least get a sense for it out of the way that the rest of the country looks down its nose at people from Appalachia. You know, we're stupid. We're slow. We talk funny. We're dumb hillbillies. We're inbred. We're incestuous. We can't be trusted. You know, we're shiftless. We're lazy. When in fact, Appalachian people are among the most industrious on the planet, because we've had to, at least in the nation, because we have had to make do with less.
Exactly.
You know, we have this habit, you know, everybody jokes about rednecks and cars up on blocks in the yard. You know why we put our cars up on blocks in the yard? Not because we have some vision of some sort of transcendent mechanical art. It's called saving them for parts.
Saving what?
Saving them for parts. And then when we go and buy another used one, we try to buy the same thing that we had before so that that one sitting up on a block can be recycled and be parted out into the one that's running.
Okay, that makes sense.
That's, and you know, hubcaps all over the place. You know what? People need hubcaps.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, all right, and there's a book called How Did the Irish Become White? And again, you know, Celtic people like black people now, and this is why I have a kindred spirit, not because of bloodlines, but very similar history, has had their history stolen from them. Going back to Julius Caesar. But Julius Caesar made his fortune off of the blood of Celtic people, the Gauls.
Sure he did. Absolutely, and I'm glad you recognize that, because it is the absolute truth, and it's something that I've remarked upon in the past. You know, people in Italy and people in Greece and the Mediterranean world in general, they had a long and well-seated religion before there was ever any hint of a gospel or an Old Testament or a new one. But they got it taken from them by the rise of the church and its bogarting of cultural traditions that did not belong to it.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you can lay that at the door of the church. I can't, being as I'm one of those people from that area, although I'm told, you know, yeah, I'm Scottish, but before that I was some sort of crazed ass Viking. The fact of the matter is, going back, there's nobody in Western Europe and nobody on the British Isles who has a real understanding for what their native religion or culture was before it was supplanted and scattered and overlain
and wiped out
by the Romans.
Yeah, because when you think about it, and I say this, if it wasn't for the discovery of the New World, Celtic people would not exist, because it was either assimilate or die or set off to some remote area. And if you look at American history when it comes to the Scotch-Irish, the ones who, guess where they are? Appalachia.
Yeah. Exactly.
Only, you know,
But from a founding there, they spread out to become a tremendous genealogical force in the expansion of America. You know, that's why, you know, that's why what our buddy Joe Bajant writes about so cogently in Deer Hunting with Jesus is so important.
You know, and that's the thing, you know, like a lot of people don't understand, black people too, and unfortunately most white people, and most white people are Scots-Irish, is that this game is divide and conquer. Okay. It really is, because the thing is, and this is when it hit me hard, is like, whenever you go to Walter Reed in Washington, D.C., in certain parts, guess who's coming in and out of there? People with accents from the Appalachian region. Mostly.
And southern accents. I mean, there's a big difference in somebody in somebody from Mingo County, West Virginia's accent, and somebody from Tidewater, Virginia's accent, and somebody from Lee County, Alabama's accent. But yeah, it's that the southern accent and variations on it, as we recognize and understand it, are all variations on Scots Irish accents. You know, not finishing one's ing words and saying n instead of ing. That's classically Irish and Scots Irish.
Yes, and, you know, you got to forgive my New Yorkerness, because to me it's all the same, too. You know. So,
well, that's okay. Everybody from that area sounds the same to me until you get up around Boston, and that's a whole nother kettle of fish.
Yes, yes. And I think the only means why, particularly, you know, not the Scots-Irish, but the Irish-Irish who came later along, they were able to hold on to much of their culture, especially in and every other group who came along, part of it, was able to have the luxury of doing so. We owe it to the Irish in particular, because they were the ones who thought up of urban political machinery.
Yeah, well, and by dint of necessity, they banded together and opposed the bigotry to which they were subjected. That's that wave of Irish immigration that comes as a result of things like the potato famine.
Yeah, because if you ever look at the gangs in New York, that movie, which is a great movie about how of historic New York history too, even though a lot of it is fictionalized, but it gives it a pretty clear of what, you know, the huge schism was between the Scotch-Irish, the ones who came before the potato famine, who had to assimilate and, you know, give up Catholic-like religions, whether it be Catholic or, you know, Anglican, and become more Protestant and Calvinist, and the newer generations who kind of stuck to the traditional Catholic faith.
Yeah.
That was the schism between the two, and that's where the fights used to occur. And believe it or not, the same thing happens within the black community. You know, I come from, you know, West Indian black. A majority of the West Indian blacks only been here post-Dr. King assassination. And then, you know, you have the older West Indian crowd who, for rival reasons, had to assimilate more into the American black community. And then, you know, you have the American black community who's always been here. And there is a huge skip in the black community, especially here in New York in the Northeast, and within New York, for African-American New York politics, especially in my district. You know? So, you know, the same thing is going on in many ways.
Oh, and I don't know. Exactly.
Yeah, it's history repeating itself.
And keep everybody at everybody else's throats, and we were here first, and it, you know, it reminded when I was viewing that video the other day of Adam Pauley, that's the guy's name, who had the skinhead tattoos and assaulted that picnic on July 4th on Cayford Mountain. I was viewing that the other day, and that one phrase really caught me. She, get off our mountain, Wiz here first. Oh, really? Were you Hiawatha?
Yeah, exactly. I was about to say, what about the red people, the reddish brown?
You were here first, were you? But that's such a classic attitude. You know, well, we invaded before you invaded.
Yeah,
and it's like being from Oklahoma and say, you know, I can trace my lineage back to the original Sooners. Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're proud of that? You're proud of being able to trace your lineage back to people who actively stole land in violation of federal law? Good on you, buddy.
Exactly. You know, and it's like. You know, I've shared with a few friends, you know, what I'm about to do in my decision. And a lot of them are like, well, why don't you give up your U.S. citizenship then? And I was like, back off, you know. It's like a total offense. And unfortunately, this is what, you know, the right wing and the power elite does. You know, they make people so invested into certain institutions like the industrial military complex, even though they're not really receiving any benefits from it or very little. And this is why, like, oh, well, if you leave Afghanistan, those 5,000 before died for nothing kind of thing. It's that, and until we face the truth, and as hard as it be, we're never going to pull out of Afghanistan or Iraq. Or we will always have a presence there because they're going to use that line. Well, if we pull out now, then those 5,000 would have died for nothing. But the reality is, I'm sorry to tell you, but they did die for nothing. They died to make Cheney and his boys rich. And I'm sorry to say it, G.I. Joe, you lost your leg to make Cheney and his homeboys rich. And until you face that, there's no change that's going to happen.
Exactly.
And this is why I've often said that I refuse. And the thing is, I've had plenty of ancestry pre-World War I, which was really the real death knell for the British. Well, the things were planned, but World War I did far more destruction to the British Empire and all. And I tell people, you know, because I've come across some very gullible guys who try to volunteer so they can serve in Iraq and all that. And I said, why are you going to do that for? And they're like, well, you know, serve my country and all this nonsense. And they're like, why should you serve and all? I said, look, my ancestry has already given up enough blood for people who don't. And make their fortunes. You know, you can do what you need to do, but that's the bottom line. You know, no Iraqi is coming around in Brooklyn to bomb up the place. Now, they may go across the water to Manhattan and do it, but they ain't coming to Texas Patterson. Or wherever I live in. I live 6 blocks away from the World Jewish Laboratory headquarters, and they're not even bombing that.
Your audio is getting kind of muffled there, Kevin.
I'm sorry. I said I live 5 blocks from the. You ever heard of the Laboratory Jewish Fair?
Oh yeah.
Okay, I live about 5.
Hardcores.
Yeah, 5 to 6 blocks away from their world headquarters. That's the ground zero for them. And they leave that untouched. So they don't hate the Jews that much. What they hate is the money and the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, much of which is not, you know, right. What they hate is us and our corporate structure and our financial finagling and messing around inside their well-being. You know, I picked up... crazy little aside. I picked up pomegranates were like 3 for $4 the other day at the grocery store. I wish they'd been organic. They weren't. But I picked up 3 pomegranates because my kids love them. And I brought one each to Doodle and Ferg and Margie. And just handing those pomegranates to them, I was reminded of that story about pomegranate growing in Afghanistan. That the planting pomegranate orchards over there, because apparently that countryside does really, really well with pomegranate trees. I don't know. I'm not an agronomist. But I was reminded of the success that that British man had in doing that, because it was long-term, it was of value, and it was a lot less dangerous than trying to raise opium poppies.
Oh, yeah.
And he went in and convinced the local farmers to raise these, set up a guaranteed buy for their produce at you know, a fair trade rate. And look at that. He just took a whole bunch out of the opium poppy market. However many opium poppies those fields would suit, he replaced with pomegranates.
Like I've said to other people before, you know how you can end the drug, the so-called illegal drug trade, which I say is kind of questionable of the morality of it? Pay people fair wages for growing regular food. Give them a good price on selling bananas and coconuts and pomegranates and things that people actually eat. You'd be surprised how unavailable cocaine and opium will become. Now, people will probably keep on smoking their ganja, which I don't mind, but you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. It's not that it's not this is no insult to you. It's not a complicated idea.
It's not. And like I said, this is why, you know, I cannot fully buy into the fundamentalist gloom and doom scenarios, because I truly believe technology will resolve anything. You remember the conversation we had last week this time, saying how we can end the tide water rising. Like, the ocean's rising, swelling up. If we filter that water and flood a lot of deserts within it, so they can have drinking water.
Yeah, desalinate and...
The technology is there. And use hydroponics to raise crops. Because the only reason why oil...
Well, compare that with the fact, but, you know, irrigation has its own problems because it salinates the soil ultimately anyway. But that's stuff that crop science can maybe solve.
Yeah.
But you know, if 70% of the Earth's farming regions are stand to be desert in 25, 35 years, I'd say the time to get to work on that would be like, you know, 100 years ago. But, yeah, I'm crazy.
Well, and the thing that the only reason why oil is such a big deal is because that's the only card they have to play. But I'm pretty sure they will stop drilling for oil tomorrow if they have an alternative. I'm almost certain of it, Bob. It's like, I'll never forget that scene in Lawrence of Arabia, the very beginning, when the guy shoots the other guy, the opposing Arab, over the water well because he's drinking. Scarcity leads to division, and that's what the right wing thrives off of, scarcity. So they're going to do everything to make things scarce so they can divide and conquer.
Right. Make everything phony, baloney, scarce, and go from there.
Exactly. And that's why... Especially scarce when there's a whole abundance of diamonds. And a whole lot of things are artificially scarce. So they can create these false positions.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah, because what? Rubies and emeralds are far... real rubies and real emeralds are far more scarce than diamonds. But an artificial market of scarcity has been created around them. Oh, and in terms of all this, by the way, you know, I mentioned at the beginning of the program that I had, you know, my 25 seconds of Lonesome Roads earlier today, you know, the rodeo clown. And be darned if he wasn't making a pitch inside the show, talking with an expert about gold.
Oh,
But here's the fun part. The guy, the expert came on and said, listen, you know, a $20, with a $20 gold piece, a man could buy a nice suit of clothes. The wool hasn't changed. Blah, 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 blah. And the guy was ripping off a speech, ripping off a riff that Tom Hartman did 2 years ago.
Oh, yes, I remember that. I was listening to that, sir. If you took a $20 gold piece, you could buy a brand new suit. If you take a $1,000 gold whatever, you can still buy the suit because that $1,000 is worth it. I remember that exactly.
You know, they can't do anything on their own. They got to bogart somebody else. They got to rip off somebody else. They got to... It just never ceases to amaze.
But, you know, and that's what it is. Scarcity creates division. And the more scarcity you create, the more division you will have. Hence, you can do whatever you want.
Not a hard concept to grasp. Kevin, thanks a lot. A lot of good food for thought this evening.
Okay, my brother.
All right, you
always
take.
A pleasure, man.
Oh man, it's a joy. We will talk soon, okay?
Okay, sir.
All right, later. Bye now.
Bye.
Calling from Brooklyn. Well, that's our buddy Kevin. Scarcity, artificial scarcity. It's a thesis worth exploring, don't you think? Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Brother Bob.
Brother Luke, how are you?
Well, better than has been, but you know how that goes. Well, let's see. Start on a couple of things I've heard you talk about while I've been on the phone. Let's see. I figure what we ought to do is we ought to put together this is my group to go over and pick up the Nobel Prize. Start off with Pat Tillman's parents.
There you go.
Let's see. The Jersey Girls.
Right.
Sandy Sheehan. The Dixie Chicks.
That would be nice.
And let's see, Jessica Lynch. Just a poke somebody in the eye for the fun of it, too.
Oh, that would be.
You know, just a nice
no Lindy England.
No, not quite. I mean, there are some others I'm sure I've left out a few here and there, but that was just a small list I just put together just off the top of my head. All right, let's see, what do we got today? Oh, let's see. I don't know if you want to get into it. I sent you the thing from the Courier Journal about what Chinless Mitch told.
Yeah, I mentioned that. I guess at the switch over from the top of the hour. Yeah, imagine feeling like you're somebody enough to tell an elder statesman of the Republican Party to shut them up about health care.
Yeah, I saw that. I went to the Courier Journal. I saw that, and I just went, yeah. It's like, say, the new Republican mantra, don't let Obama get a win anywhere. It's like, oh, well.
We're already hearing from some high-ranking Republicans that we shouldn't do that. That's helping the president, Dole said. He later specified that the people he referred to included one very prominent Republican who happens to be the Republican leader of the Senate.
But I ain't going to mention it by name.
Except that I won't mention names except to say that he hasn't got a chin.
It's true. Oh, I tell you what. The one I liked this weekend was our I don't know what to call him anymore, I guess. He's not quite media whore number one now, but he's working on it, is Mr. Kurtz.
Oh, yeah, we had lots of fun with Mr. Kurtz at the beginning of the program.
Oh, okay. The one where he was going after the lady from the White House, and I'm sitting there going, look, when you got when they were running W's press releases all the way down to the typos, I mean, how else do you want to refer to them as other than as a wing of the Republican Party?
I don't know how you can. I don't know what else there is.
You know what I mean? I mean, when they were including typos, I mean, you could have the hand thing there in the White House and they're copying it was the same words. I mean, either that or somebody's damn good clairvoyant. I got to tell you, somebody should be able to be asking about lottery numbers. Oh, God. And to be something else CNN did the last couple of nights. What is going on with their, I don't know what you want to call it, their special reports division? We get a special report on Jonestown? What was it, 25 years ago? 30?
Ah, well, don't blame them. They just noticed.
I'm just sitting there going, well, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I understand it's, you know, an important event in history. But why now? I mean, you know, I'm sorry. I think there's a few more things you could be covering. You know what I mean? It's like, what's the big push on this? I mean, it just blew my mind. I'm just sitting there going, you know, because there's a lot of the things more recent we could be covering, spending our time on, when you all claim you don't have time enough and resources enough to even keep, you know, foreign offices open. You know, somebody up and down the line is much more, I like the story. Let's run it. But, no, the one that got me today was you saw the thing Mr. Kurtz had his little article comparing Mr. Letterman with Mr. Ensign. No, let's compare Mr. Letterman with Mr. Ensign. Let's compare Mr. Letterman with Mr. O'Reilly. I said, you know, it's more like,
yeah, because, you know, Mr. Ensign is a family values Republican who has trumpeted his, right.
But, I mean, the thing is, he's trying to compare them, and I'm sitting there going, no, why don't we compare what happened in the media? You know, when one guy has had to essentially admit he was sexually harassing a member of his staff until he paid her off. But, oops, I don't remember Kurtz and Company getting all that blown up when Bill O'Reilly did it. You know, I don't remember them doing hours and hours of coverage on it like they have with David Letterman.
Yeah, me either, oddly enough.
And you know what? I won't say it's good. It's something to be admired. But you know what? These were the Letterman thing. These were unmarried people. You know, unmarried people can get in all kinds of different little combinations. You know, Bill at the time, I think, was a thing called a married man. You know, so you know.
And you know, just checking. When's the last time David Letterman opined on family values?
You know what I mean? It's like I say, David admits, you know, tells what he is. You know, I mean, he comes right up there for the most part and says it. I mean, it's just like, look, guys, these were unmarried people at the time because they're wanting to complain like he was married at the time. It's like, he's just been married like 6 months, even that. Okay, he was dating this woman. Fine, they're dating. There's a lot of different rules of dating. I mean, more than one people at a time. It's not, you know, not everybody does it, but some do. But, you know, that's here or there. What else do we have? What else? Oh, there was something else I'm trying to think of. Oh, the story on the things with ESPN and the pig man. Apparently some of these people at the Rams are essentially saying, we don't want him.
Well, I've been reading some follow-up along the way. Mostly the commentary from players within the NFL saying, yeah, sorry, I don't care how much money he's got. I wouldn't play for him.
The head of the Players Association?
Yep.
It's coming up. I'm sorry, but, you know, it's like, say, Rush made all these statements. Now we can go back and look at them. Let's see what Rush has said over the years, just for the fun of it.
Call me back when you get that bone out of your nose. Ha, ha, ha. That's funny to white people.
Yeah, it's like say, yeah, you're going to put him in charge. You want him to purchase an organization, you know, that is about 85% African American, most likely. You know, I'm sorry, but that, you know, that's just the way the demographics break down on it. You know, I'm just sitting there going, I don't think, like I say, and I still say, you know, they've done it before, that the NFL, you know, has said people can't buy into their companies because of morals problems. Like I said, if somebody ring the bell, we got a winner.
Yep, there's another toaster out the window.
But, two other things. First of all, how's the money? I didn't get to hear you from the beginning. Have you made your quota?
We made enough to get the lupine pest off the porch and continue past October 21st. We made the $1,100 mark.
I didn't know if I counting my letter.
Counting the regular monthly contributions and throwing that into the pot too, we're in good shape. We made that part. That just means that we've got until October the 31st to make the regular monthly bills.
Well, sorry, I sent you what I could, bud. You know how it is.
And it is much appreciated.
Well, it's one of those things. I'm sorry. Me and PayPal have a generous hate of each other, so that's why I just sent cash.
Understood. Understood completely.
I think PayPal to me, every time I look at it, I just want to just get a cold shiver and go, no!
Well, I'd love it. I'd love it if there was a less rapacious, less avaricious, less nefarious alternative, but I've yet to find it.
Okay. All right, now on to our favorite subject. Did you get to watch Mr. Rodriguez have a meltdown?
He done, old Plugs Rodriguez done come unglued.
it's like, say, we just threw a boy off our team last week for acting like that. You know, it's like anybody that walked within the 10-foot radius of him, he just went off on, apparently, for what they were showing.
Oh, he's got a vile temper. I mean, I remember when he dropped West Virginia like a hot rock. This would be the head coach of Michigan, formerly the head coach of WVU, for those of you who hate sports and will send me emails telling me how much you do. But Patrick White, who was a fine young man, I think it was Pat White, after Rodriguez left and they were having their practices, somebody said, well, how's it going, Pat? And he said, you know, I got to tell you, it's nice to practice and not be called names and sworn at all the time.
Uh-huh.
But what I found most interesting was that, in the fourth quarter, was it, he pulled Tate Forcier,
yep,
this guy who had been the second coming of Tom Brady,
mm-hmm,
and he benched him.
Yeah.
Rodriguez did. And then later, the local sports media there in Ann Arbor said, well, is there a problem between you and Tate? And, of course, the Plugs Rodriguez said, well, no, there aren't any problem between me and Tate, and everything's just fine, and you people just do fine to quit making stuff up. And then the University of Michigan conveniently refused to allow Tate Forcier to have access to the media.
I just watched that, and I just went, you know, something. I was sitting there going, something about to happen, because, I mean, he just blew a few. You know, I'm just sitting there going, somebody must have hit him when the camera wasn't looking or something, because I said, if man has that kind of a fit on the sideline, that's when they need to go over and put something in his Gatorade and give it to him. Here you go.
Well, I'm thinking his next big Gatorade bath's going to be more vinegar than Gatorade.
Well, we had a week. We actually did something right. Why, we don't know, but we did.
Look at little quarterback Crompton looking like an NCAA SEC quarterback. He had a couple of dodgy moments, but he looked okay.
Well, you know how it is. We get a week off, and then we get to go. We get to go down to beautiful Birmingham or Tuscaloosa. We get to go down and play with the gentleman with the elephant.
Oh, and you know, even though I'm an alumnus of the Capstone, I will be anxiously hoping that the boys in Volunteer Orange can.
Well, see, this weekend they
do what needs doing.
I think this weekend they play the Gamecocks. The old ball coach.
Yeah, I think he'll be a little bit of letdown from Georgia on that one.
We'll see.
Now, I don't, and let me just get this out of the way, Luke. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to take anything away from the Tennessee victory, but I don't think Georgia was all it was cooked up to be.
Either. I mean, you know, we thought they were better than that. I mean, that just wasn't the team I saw a team play a couple of games earlier this season. Either that or the people they were playing were worse. That's hard to imagine. I mean, we had some good plays and all that stuff, and I think the what their like catch and fumble that Eric Berry caught, I don't know how that didn't make the top 10 plays of the week.
That was pretty stunning.
That was like watching circus people play in the circus, I tell you. But you know, I mean, it's just one of those things. I mean, you're just sitting there watching, going, I've off and on watched, you know, a couple of games this year, and they played pretty good then. And I'm sitting there going, well, if they're playing this bad now, then the people they play must really be bad, because they did not get into the
race. Well, you know, I sat there and watched LSU and Florida, and I thought all along that LSU was overrated.
Well, they were, but the thing of it was, I'm sorry.
And if Florida is the best team in college football ain't got much to say for itself.
Well, the thing of it was, we were just sitting there, and that turned the sound off, because I tell you what, I think if Tebow were to run for president, Vern Lundquist would vote for him 100 times. You know?
Oh, look, there were actual references on ESPN, and I think possibly on CBS as well. There were actual, there was a reference to Jesus H. Tebow.
Yep, I saw that one.
Well, no, that's just me. No, there was a reference to him using the language of the 23rd Psalm.
Well, one of our local sports people that was commenting on it. He said, "So you remember the play where the LSU man's shirt folding backwards, you know, on the pass play down for one of the touchdowns. Said, you know, Vernon just kind of laughed about it and said, you know, isn't that, you know, just got away with a little bit of fun. He said, you know, if it had been the other way around, the LSU player had done that, Vernon would have been claiming how that was a crime against man. You know, and we could have a summary execution. You know, I don't mind, you know, if somebody plays, you know, and the announcer tells you they like somebody, you know, that's fine. I mean, they're human. But, you know, it's just one of those things. It's like, guys, after a while, just hearing that.
Well, here in the ESPN crowd, and bear in mind, I'm one of these long view college football guys. Mm-hmm. I actually know who Red Grange was. I know who Jim Thorpe was, and I know why they are listed as being the great, among the greatest of the great. I even go so far as to, never mind. But anyway, to sit there and hear them say, and Tim Tebow is a great college football player, and there are a lot of great college football players, but he may be among the best that have ever played the game.
Somewhere Jim Brown just spit up.
Yeah, right. Yeah, man. Bring that little pasty faced boy over here. I may be 70 years old, but I think I can run over him still. Because Jim Brown probably could.
Yeah, I know.
You know, and you know, if he heard it, Sam Huff's sitting there somewhere going, "I'm suiting up."
Where's Rosie Greer when you need him? Come on, Rosie. Oh, I say, where's Supreme Court Justice Alan Page. Where are you, sir?
Yeah, let's talk, son. But you know, again, that's not Tebow saying all this about himself.
You know, that's one of the ones where whoever's in charge of the network, the sports division.
Right, and if I can draw a little line here between a couple of dots, mm-hmm. and make this relevant to people who don't care about college football, let me suggest that going back to way back when, and I don't know if people still remember this, I do, way back when ABC News put Rune Arledge in charge of the news when he'd been running the sports division, it's a transformative moment in the history of media, and secondly, the fawning in sports coverage has carried over into news coverage to the point that it's not that sports is covered. It's not that ESPN came along and now sports is covered like news. It's that beginning with Rune Arledge's transition from ABC Sports to ABC News, news is covered like sports.
Yeah. I mean, when you sit back and like say, you go back, what was it, 2-3 years ago, and we have the thing with Brian Williams at the journalist thing, him and MC Rose. You know, I mean, I'm sorry, but, you know, there's something.
That was David Gregory, wasn't it?
Oh, David Gregory. I apologize to Mr. Williams. David Gregory, you're right. But, you know, when something like that happens, then somewhere in the back of your head, don't do it. Don't do it.
The smart money says don't.
Yeah, no. It's like, say, you know, it's like Robin Williams said. Robin Williams used to say, he said most people have that little voice in their head that don't do it. Said, mine's back there cheering me on, going, do it, do it, do it, do it. That's fine for a comedian, but not good for a newsman. Oh, well. Well, I tell you what, but I'm going to let you go on. I know I've kept you too long. So I will talk at you later in the week or maybe next week.
All right. You take care, Luke. Good to hear from you, brother.
See you.
All right. Later. Bye. Bye. All right. We got some good conversation going on this evening. Let's not make folks wait. Okay. You're not there. Neither are you. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello?
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 Hello, hello.
Hello? Greetings.
Here, greetings.
Welcome to the program.
Hey, this is Grant from Portland.
Oh, hey, how you doing, Grant?
Pretty good. Can you have a hard time hearing me?
You're breaking up a little bit, but we're okay.
All righty. Well, hey, I wanted to run a couple things by you and hear your thoughts about it.
Okay.
So if you'll indulge me, I'd like to share with you my little shoebox of breadcrumbs called Middle East Facts.
Okay. I anxiously await them.
Okay. Well, it's kind of interesting because Friday on Malloy, they had Rush Limbaugh going off on the President's Award. And the interesting thing is that he mentioned the Taliban in Iran. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
Rush did? Because I'm pretty sure that Rush mentioned the Taliban in Iran?
Correct. And I think it was Slip. But in and of itself, it probably doesn't seem anything more than, you know, a guffaw. But I sort of have these other things that I'm looking at that I've been kind of collecting over time. And there's just sort of separate points. And I think he let it slip because it basically reveals their true intentions all along. I've heard other shows where ex-military officers have called in and given an approach to think the true goals are. And they seem to be coming up with a push into Iran.
Oh, they want it so bad they can taste it. They still want to get back at them for the embassy in the late 70s.
Right, among other things. Well, the thing is interesting because I think Brian called in and he said that the Saudis gave the Russians an inducement to kind of drop back, withdraw their anti-missile, anti-aircraft support, or the tech support for it, and just kind of hang back. And so I see the Saudis making moves against Iran.
Oh yeah, the Saudi and Grant and this may be where you're going. So forgive me if I'm just jumping in, but
okay.
let's remember that there are I don't know which verb tense to use, but there's a pastiche of differing religious sects in that region. And in this case, the Saudis, who are largely Sunni, even though they are virulently fundamentalist Sunni, don't like Shia Islam worth a damn. It's one of the fundamental mistakes that Americans make in trying to differentiate between Sunni and Shia and any of the other particular branches is we think that it's like the difference between Presbyterians and Lutherans. It's not. It is blood feud. For one thing, Islam is younger by about 600 years than Christianity. And Christianity has its own blood-soaked history, much of which happened in its first millennium of existence.
Yes.
I charted this out one time, Grant, and I don't mean to take you away from your fundamental points, but I think this is it's relevant to what you're discussing. At roughly the same point in its history relative to, okay, when Christianity was 1,400 years old, what was it doing? When Christianity was 1,400 years old, it was burning people at the stake. It was murdering Jews. It was declaring heresies here, there, and everywhere if you didn't believe exactly as Rome said. And it was a nightmare upon the planet because of the violence that it engaged in. That's not to say that the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, the Serbian Orthodox, the Armenian Orthodox, the Egyptian Coptic Church, yada, 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 that they were all, you know, pure as the driven snow. But by virtue of sheer size, the Roman Catholic Church was doing the most of the work, and most of the work being done by the Roman Catholic Church was bloody and violent. So, you know, the Christianity has no room to complain about the conduct of Islam when, in fact, at the same age, Christianity was engaging in the same sort of bloody, violent excesses of which we complain about Muslim structure.
Well, not only that, but I would also add to that, let's take that and supersize it, shall we? Liberty University. I mean, the uber madrasa of Christo-fascism.
Oh, hello. Yeah, that's very true.
That lead to, okay? I mean, basically, you know, it's one corporate military smash and grab after the other for resources, so.
Very true.
Yeah.
So, I, you know, just to get back to where we were going,
sure.
Pakistan's version of Islam hates Iran. Saudi Arabia's version of Islam hates Iran. Israel hates Iran just on general principle because they think, and to a certain extent rightly so, that Iran has funded some degree of terrorism in what they perceive to be their homeland. So the question then becomes, are Iran's fears paranoia, or are they legitimate?
I think their fears are legitimate, but they'll never miss an opportunity to whip up paranoia.
I think you're spot on, because any authority, and it is, you know, I'm not making any apologies for their form of government. It is a paranoid regime. Because all authoritarian, you know, witness the last 8 years here, all authoritarian regimes are paranoid regimes.
Uh-huh.
Because by virtue of the fact that they're out to get everybody, they're convinced that everybody is in turn out to get them. Some of this I'm out of my depth on in terms of psychology, but I think that Rick Goodnerhorn, psychotherapist, would probably back me up.
I think we have a reasonable expectation of that, yes.
So going forward from that, the Saudis and the Pakistanis. So do please proceed now that I have gone down the garden path.
Well, it's interesting you see it from a more of a tribal conflict thing, but it's just like what I'm trying to do is sort of get my head around the entire constellation of forces and interests on this. It's obvious that the Saudis would love to take all their rivals out. And it seems clear by that sort of line of thinking that they're going to use us as a hand at their bidding, you know, in that regard. It kind of struck me that, and I can't quite characterize this to myself, I don't know quite how to see this. I know McChrystal, I mean, in my estimation, McChrystal went a long way outside acceptable conduct to ensure that his troop levels were rare. You know what I'm saying? The brinksmanship, the political brinksmanship.
Well, yeah, and he negotiated it like a car salesman. He has a number in his head of American soldiers that he would like to see redeployed to Afghanistan. He therefore submitted a number that was higher than that by a factor of whatever his calculation was.
Uh-huh.
And as a consequence, his hope is to get his actual number by negotiating downward.
Right, and since he got an extra 20,000 already, he's asking for 120 to get 70. So he figures he'll just make up 60 one by hook or by crook somehow in negotiations, right?
Right.
That's what I see. I mean, that's what I see coming.
No, I think you're 100% correct. And yeah. It's a shame that we wind up discussing these things in such cynical terms. But this is from its very origin, Grant, and feel free to disagree with me if you wish. This is a very cynical war. This was one of literally the poorest planet, the poorest nations on the planet. It was barely a nation. You know, if you recall the words of Donald Rumsfeld, he said he wanted to go into Iraq because there was nothing fun to bomb in Afghanistan.
Uh-huh.
No, that's the level of psychosis we were I'm sorry.
No, it's treating our infrastructure, our military infrastructure, like a toy.
And so it has ever been among the right wing.
Well, and to pursue that a little further, I mean, it goes to a point earlier that you mentioned. I think this is at the heart of, in part, the cultural war within the country, our country, going on. The rift between the military, intelligence, congressional, scientific complex and the public that it extracts its resources from. You know, all that stuff is right at the core of it. They're happy to extract resources from us in the form of taxes and other duties and all this other stuff. But it's as if they're the permanent emplacement around which we are just window dressing.
Right, and God forbid that we, and God forbid that we the people ever get uppity about what they're doing with those resources that they extract, Grant. You know, because I know I've heard it said that I've heard the argument made that it's unfair to say, well, you know, we spend X billion a month in Iraq killing people, but somehow or another we can't seem to afford to spend that same kind of money taking care of our own people. And the argument being that, well, you know, those are apples and oranges, and truly, you know, one of them is national security, and one of them is, you know, something frivolous like health care, and that making that accusation is somehow patently unfair because of the separate nature of the two issues. I reject that, because the fact of the matter is we would like to, a significant majority of this country would like to have our national treasure used to set up a healthcare system that doesn't break us every time with every illness. And we are deserving of it because, as we were reminded so many times on the 2000 campaign trail by George W. Pinhead, I mean Bush, hey, it's your money. Well, it is our money. And we'd like to have it used on a healthcare plan. Thank you very much. And the sooner we get out of Afghanistan and the sooner we get out of Iraq, the more likely it is that we can use that money that way. Because remember, we're still writing hot checks for both of those wars. It's just got a different signature on the check now. Whereas, you know, a healthy, medically well American workforce can actually work off those hot checks a whole lot better than a corpse coming home in a box. Sorry, I guess I'm being cranky tonight, Grant.
Crank on. No, I concur with you. I think it's high time people got cranky, started questioning the methods and the goal selection and the method selection of this permanent government complex. Okay? Seriously. And, you know, I think people are going to be, as they begin to question, and they are tend to be discredited, ridiculed, or marginalized, they're going to find it increasingly difficult. They're going to find an upward ramp to the overhead of dismissing criticisms of obviously, patently obvious flaws in it. And good God, where the hell is the Powell Doctrine? It's not even being considered. It's not even being used.
You mean that overbearing air superiority?
Not so much the air superiority,
but just overpowering force.
No, it's not just that. It is that you have an entrance plan. Yes, you have overwhelming force, but you have an entrance plan, and for God's sake, have an exit plan. I mean, the basics. This is supposed to be the culmination of what we learned in Vietnam as a nation, but we have a fifth column, in my estimation, that absolutely jettisons these kinds of lessons. You know, they're willfully amnesiatic because it doesn't square with the resource agenda that they're trying to pursue. It's at the heart of it. I did want to touch on one more thing, though. Did you hear about the Sabelle Edmonds story?
No.
No.
Well, I mean, I've followed a lot of it via Brad Friedman, but I'm not sure exactly to which you refer.
Well, here's the curious thing. This is one of my breadcrumbs given to me by the independent media. Thank you very much. Sabelle Edmonds was an FBI translator, and she was living under a gag order for some time because what she uncovered in the course of her duties is that a number of political figures, and you can find this on Brad's blog, and you can find it on the Peter B. Collins podcast.
Right, I've been following Brad's coverage of it, Mercy, since 2004.
Okay, so you're familiar with the material?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the thing that occurs to me is, okay, we've got Turkey obtaining our nuclear secrets, funneling it to AQ Khan in Pakistan. We get, you know, basically, big noises about mushroom clouds all of a sudden. The very people who are trying to keep the non-proliferation, trying to enforce non-proliferation, are being undermined systematically in our government.
Right.
Okay. You've got this fifth column active looking for oil, basically, among other things, you know, add to the basket, I guess. But the thing I hear that, I'm losing my train of thought. You can't see where I'm going, and it's like, we have this stuff going on here. We've got, a presence there. I don't know if we're going to try to push into Iran with 60,000 extra troops. Might seem foolish. You know, to me it would be. But I don't know where these guys are going to go. I'm left to wonder, because they don't seem to follow established, proven doctrine militarily. See what I mean?
Yes.
And they seem almost capricious. You know what I mean? This is my sense of what they're doing. And so it makes me a bit nervous about empowering any of them. But I don't see it. I'm going with this, right?
Yes, I do. I'm with you.
Okay. The thing about Afghanistan to me is this. I think we got three things to do. I think we have to make sure that what our traitors in our government, the Turks and the Pakistanis did to get the nukes going, does not fall into the hands of the Peshmerga forces. Okay, the Pashtun forces.
Right.
We need to not invade Iran. We need to get the hell out. And on the way out, we need to rebuild the waterways so they can get back in the food business and out of the narcotics trade. I think we have to do any three of those. Actually, the first three I mentioned. Last one would be excellent, in my opinion. But I don't know if we're ever going to do that. You know? But I think if we miss any one of those first three, we're going to get our butts handed to it. And it's either now or it's going to be somewhere down the road because of all the new angry relatives we have against us. See what I mean? And
Yes, I do.
How do we do that? And particularly, how do we accomplish that with a cowboy like McChrystal? That's my concern.
And I think it is a well placed concern.
Indeed.
I don't know. I mean, you know, McChrystal's being hailed as a reasonably intelligent person, as opposed to one of the toady bootlicks of the, you know, because remember, you didn't, if you were a general in the Bush administration and you had an opinion that was even a dime's worth of contrary to Donald Rumsfeld's psychotic visions, you got cashiered.
Yeah, so you probably were labeled radical.
Was it Eric Shinseki?
Yeah.
Who said, you know, if we're going to do Iraq, we need to do Iraq with 500,000 at least.
Hmm.
And they said, you know, you're looking a little crotchety there, General. What do you think? It's time for you to retire and quit talking that 500,000 man army crazy talk. And poof, he was gone.
Many others too.
Yeah, many others. Yeah, and junior officers as well. There was precious little coverage of it, frankly. But there was, you know, during the Bush administration, just as they did inside the civil servant government, they did the same thing in the military. There was a purge. There was a Stalin-esque purge grant. You know, you've got, we had the stories of, remember Monica Goodling?
No, I don't actually.
Monica Goodling was the Justice Department toady who graduated from the 247th best law school in the country. You know, Pat Robertson School of Law.
Oh, the Uber Madrasa.
Yeah, and she got a number two or number, you know, she was Justice Department number two, you know, or three or so, and she was like the White House liaison to the Justice Department or something, and it turned out that she had actively, with other fundamentalist cronies inside the Justice Department, she had actively worked at placing real fundamentalist freaks inside the civil service that we won't ever root out.
You know, that's one of the things that and the earlier points you made about the military purge are the things that give me profound concern. It's because, you know, with and this is something I don't, I mean, this is the basis of my concern, because it is apparent to me that we've got this sort of unholy alliance, medical, anarcho-fascism, you've got the Christo-fascism, you've got all these forces just absolutely digging their feet in and sprouting roots right into the very, basement of these governmental institutions. And although it seems they perfectly and predictably, go through and purge all non-compliance and non-adherence, when it comes down to it, and even though they're doing improper, illegal things, they're telling judges what their schedule is, and they're telling judges what to do. When did that start happening? Okay. How is it that when the progressives get in power, they put a thick folder in there? And this kind of thing. Now, beware of smooth transitions. Because I just got fooled again, and that's where I come from with that, because now we're never going to get these guys out.
Well, and look, they're
busy busting Siegelman for something that's not even illegal. And they won't even arrange the deck chairs on Canary and those a-holes, okay?
Yeah.
It's like they won't even correct the structural improprieties.
And add this much to your misgivings, Grant. Thanks to the brilliant work of Mikey Weinstein at the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, we know what it takes to get out of, say, Colorado Springs, with a commission from the Air Force Academy. And one of those things that's required is to be a religious fundamentalist. We have an Air Force right now, and the same is true to a lesser extent, but certainly to a significant extent, at Annapolis and the United States Military Academy at West Point. We have a junior officer corps, a majority of whom, especially in the Air Force, have a personal relationship with their Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Okay, we're talking about people who believe that the Earth is 6,000 years old. We're talking about people who believe in talking snakes. We're talking about people who believe that Jesus, that when they push the little red button, it's because Jesus wants that person dead. And I will submit to you that 20 years from now, probably upwards of 95% of the senior general staff will be religious fundamentalists. It's not about rooting them out. It's about the damage that's already been done. 95% of the general staff of our military will be religious fundamentalists who believe that it's okay if the world is engulfed in flames, because that helps Jesus get back faster. Let that settle in for a couple of minutes, and then watch the little beads of sweat start popping out around your hairline. These guys were thinking long term. It was not a joke when that Bush administration official looked at, and I can't remember his name now, said, but while you people are studying history, we're making it. You say, what do we do about McChrystal? I'm worried about what we do with Second Lieutenant Thumbfingers.
I hear you.
Because that guy is going to make McChrystal look like Patton. And Patton was nuts. But he was at least effective with what he did. Meanwhile, I guess in kind of a counterpoint to what you are saying, to what you've argued about McChrystal and about Afghanistan and Lord knows Iran, I got an email earlier today from our buddy Tosh. And Tosh listens a day late. So today he got Friday's show. And he said, listening to your discussion with Sandra of the new strategic admissions by the Obama administration with respect to the Taliban, I think you've missed the positive side of the mental gymnastics they're engaged in. Up until recently, the goal was complete annihilation of the Taliban, which, as you rightly have pointed out, will not be happening anytime soon. I think this admission is leading us in a direction where we get our military out of Afghanistan. Start with admitting that, like the U.S. Continentals, the Taliban will remain. With a reference to the American Revolution. Next step, and there are rumblings that this is already happening, is to start talking to Taliban leaders. You've proved you can kill them, so talking to them is now acceptable. Now, if we can get the Taliban to act like any other tribal warlord or warlord group, we can deal with them diplomatically and we can leave. Anyone, and this is Tasha's argument, anyone you can talk to, if you're willing to talk, is someone you don't have to fight. That's probably straight out of Lao Tzu when you get right down to it, you know. He says, Tosh says, I know it got lost in the rest of the posturing about McChrystal's comments at Oxford, but he started with the admission that the only way to win in Afghanistan is to apply massive amounts of humility, not a GOP strong point. This also leads us in the direction of leaving. These are tribal cultures where our attempts to even do good things, digging wells, backfire, so it's time to defer to the tribal leaders while getting them to collaborate with each other. Building a memo of understanding with those folks leaves us with an honorable exit. We will have achieved a level of success in Afghanistan that exceeds even that of Alexander. We will have figured out how to help without fighting. Looking back on recent history, I've read reports that that what won for the Taliban the hearts of Afghans was their intention and ability to stop the fighting between warlords. As the Taliban took over much of Afghanistan, saw what little peace they've known in the last 30 years. It may have been a brutal, repressive peace that looked pretty repugnant to Westerners, but for the home folks, it was peace. And Tosh says, perhaps these guys, including McChrystal, can get this right. I think they're moving in the right direction. We just don't know it yet.
Interesting, optimistic point.
I think it is optimistic, and frankly, some optimism is called for from time to time. I hope maybe that somewhere in one of the private conversations, you know, McChrystal's looking at Obama and saying, listen, I want to get out because we can't win this. We can have what we term a successful outcome, but we cannot win. And frankly, recognizing that that is an unwinnable war, is the beginning of wisdom, so to speak. You know, admitting one's own ignorance is the beginning of wisdom. But you're absolutely right. As long as the American military is there, Grant, it's not going to contribute to stability. It's going to contribute to instability in the region because of the very nervousness that you've described among the Iranians with respect to the Pakistanis and with respect to the Saudis. And hey, let's not forget that there is a heavily nuclear armed India within a stone's throw. And all of this contributes to the argument that I have put forward and I have yet to hear a valid refutation of, and that is, if you were Iran and you knew that there was a nuclear-armed Israel that would blow you up in a minute, but even if you take Israel out of the equation, if you know that there is a non-nuclear Saudi Arabia that can wag us like the tail wagging the dog, you've got nuclear-armed India and nuclear-armed Pakistan. And all three of those are of a virulently different version of Islam than you and hate your guts. Wouldn't you want a couple of nukes, too, just to tell them, hey, listen, you know, we ain't going out quietly. Because remember, Iran, and this is part of that tribalism that I was discussing, that I was putting forward, Grant, and I don't do it with any sense of a lack of respect. But remember that the genesis, oh dear, probably wrong word, the origins of Shia Islam lie in a murder. Because Islam by that point had been, you know, it's all predicated on a hereditary caliphate, right?
Yeah.
And Ali was murdered, who was the nephew of the prophet. Was murdered by the uncle of the prophet. And the prophet's uncle's followers go on to become Sunni Islam, and the prophet's nephew's followers go on to become Shia. And frankly, it is a blood feud that has existed now for 1,500 years. And Shia Islam is considerably different than Sunni Islam. Plus, you've got it taking root inside the old Persian Empire, And that culture is radically different than Arab culture. It is not the same culture. And it's not the same culture as what is up in Pakistan and, in fact, Afghanistan. They are radically different. And overlayered on this, something that a Muslim from the Indian subcontinent once told me, he said, you must remember that while Islam, and he was Muslim, so he wasn't, you know, it's not like he was being critical, but he said, you must remember that the Quran says that there is no racism, there is no bigotry, that we are all to submit ourselves to Allah. But he said the reality of it is, if you are an Arab Muslim thinks he is by definition better than an Indian Muslim, better than a Persian Muslim, better than a European Muslim, better than a Malaysian or Indonesian Muslim, because they are Arabs and they were the first.
Oh, yeah, I know. And they're super special, just ask them. Yeah, I got that part about the Saudi.
And of course, you know, the Saudis, that history right there, you know, it used to be that the Americans could go into these regions, and because we had not been meddling in their affairs, we could do business. You know, the whole reason that the royal house of Ibn Saud rules that Saudi Arabian, that Arabian Peninsula for the most part, excluding Yemen, the reason that they rule that, it has everything in the world to do with America. Because we went in and did business with them and supported them when they displaced the Hashemites. Remember the Hashemites? I mean, you know, they were the ones that the British worked with, and Lawrence of Arabia and everything, and the British made promises. But by 1925, we had helped the royal house of Ibn Saud to eject the Hashemites. And instead, the Hashemites get table leavings, and they get Jordan, and at one point the Hashemites were the kings of Iraq.
Right.
Sorry, I didn't mean to just take this completely over.
I'd forgotten that, actually. No, I'd forgotten that, actually, but it's irrelevant. Yeah.
And now, because of that business relationship that was set up in the teens and 1920s, for all intents and purposes, in the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States of America, one country is the client state of the other, but which one is the patron and which one is the client is entirely a blurred distinction at this point.
Interesting.
Because they hold a lot of that bad paper too. China's got a lot of it, but they hold some too.
Did you take a look at the crash course link I sent you?
Yes, I did.
That's probably the best diagnosis I've ever heard of our situation. Internal. It really is. And it has everything to do with what's happening.
Well, you're talking about, it seems to identify, as far as, I didn't go way far into it, but I did look at it, but it seems to identify the seamlessness of it. You know, that there is not one discipline that's politics and another discipline that's finance and another discipline that is, no, it shows the assimilation of all three into one big mess. And you're right, it's trouble.
Well, if you can go all the way to the conclusion, I would urge you to do so at your leisure. But did you get to the part of the exponential functions and this kind of thing?
Yeah, and I was already familiar with some of that.
Okay, great. See, that's sort of what I was talking about. And yeah, you know, this is why, and I think Tom brought this to my attention. You know, the libertarian thing, objectivism, is based around a philosophy developed by an author who was a child of a revolution in Russia, where economics and culture, politics are one and the same thing. It's all one movement, you know. It's all one reality. Not separate disciplines, each with their distinct area of focus.
No.
You know, differing set of tools for each one. It is one conglomeration and it's used, you know, heavily in identity politics. And this is, and they've never been able to really satisfy or refute, deal with, engage those points and make a valid case. To the contrary, see what I mean? To this day, I get to hear it.
And that was the phrase, that was the word I was trying to remember earlier in talking with Susan, objectivism. Which is you know the title that Ayn Rand gave to what turned out to be anarcho-Randianism, because it is it's an argument for economic anarchy.
Yeah, I read a lot of science fiction where they've taken this sort of to its logical conclusion, and it's kind of interesting because in each case, whether the technology is significant or otherwise, it is this conglomeration of something resembling Somalia in each case.
And you know what? I think it was Ben Birch who pointed that out, that the logical end of laissez-faire capitalism is Somalia. You know, pure survival of the fittest, nobody comes to a good end. You know, it's
to further my critique. I mean, think about that for a second. I mean, isn't that a de-evolving process? You are systematically or structurally disengaging all of the forward evolutionary momentums of the neocortex, and you're going retrograde back to mammalian and reptilian thought and empowering it above all other things. I mean, isn't that really what that is?
Well, it absolutely is, and it's also. It's also that movement toward chaos, isn't that sort of, you know, what's the second law of thermodynamics, that everything moves toward entropy? Isn't that a form of entropy, that chaos you're describing? Where, you know, nothing can get done? Because you know what? You can't, when you've got Somalia, as is obviously the case, you don't have you can't have. You know, look at the attempts that have been made. You cannot have a viable nation-state. You know, and it's devolutionary as well, Grant, because the forward momentum, so to speak, was from tribal, you know, clan to tribal group, to chiefdom, big man, to to city state, to nation state. You know, we describe this stuff as, you know, the 20th century as the rise of the nation state. And everything that you're talking about with them is backward motion. You know, to where look at ancient Greece. Ancient Greece was an agglomeration of you know, their word for it was polis, P-O-L-I-S, hence Indianapolis, Annapolis, that kind of stuff. Polis, city, but and hence our word politics and politician.
Policy,
exactly. They couldn't survive because no one could achieve some degree of hegemonic status. And there we are talking about hegemons like Sandra was Friday night. I just love the way these conversations work out.
I always enjoy our conversations, Bob.
Well, Grant, thank you very much for so very much food for thought this evening. I'm sure I'll get emails one of the beauties of what happens even outside the live broadcast is what happens afterward. From folks either hearing it on the replay stream after Malloy, or hearing it on the Horn Zone rerun stream, or hearing it via a podcast, is that all of this food for thought turns into somebody's lunch, somebody's dinner, and it gets chewed over at length. And then after folks have had a chance to digest it a little bit, I get really neat emails like the one I got from Tosh.
I think I like that. I feel that this kind of medium that we're sort of all exploring together, it's like reaching across the table and reaching into Minneapolis to have a conversation over coffee.
Yes.
Stretched out, you can talk. And I love the fact we've got to find a way to help shore up your finances, certainly. But I love the fact that we can just stretch out, talk, and examine these things, and sort of add that to the collective, you know, force multiplier of everybody considering. You know, I really like that.
I do too. And
looking for solutions, you know.
Right, because being where we are on the side of the debate that we are on, Grant, no left-wing or progressive or liberal attempt to do this sort of thing, be it talk radio or what we call conversation radio, can ever by definition be successful in the right-wing terms of delivering marching orders. See, that is the genius of Fox, and that's the genius of Limbaugh and O'Reilly and Beck and the Savage Wiener and that whole crowd, is that they are dealing with an audience that is receptive to being told not to think, but to go and do. That's not what a liberal or a progressive will ever do. That's why I shy away from, you know, go ye therefore and do marching orders. Because it's at the heart of the rejection of authoritarianism.
Well, yeah, exactly. I was going to say, I mean, that's the beauty of what this is. It's antithetical to authoritarianism.
It's process-based, it's consensus-based, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think over the long term, we'll actually accomplish a lot more. I mean, we've got, instead of, suppressing minds, thwarting development, we're actually encouraging the opposite of that as a direction. Only good thing come from that. I'll tell you something. The Fox Newses of the world and any spawn of Goebbels here is going to find this, like all other imperial momentums, basically. It's one of those things of diminishing returns and increasing overhead. I think that's their fate. I think that's what's going to happen. Because look what they build up in order to have this suppressive regime and engine. And look what it takes to run the place.
Yeah. And again, taking that long view, look 20 years down the road. What happens when those new hires from the Bush administration, those young earth fundamentalists who believe in talking snakes and dinosaurs that coexisted with mankind, what happens when they are the senior hire and fire of our civil service and our military? Then we're in a sure enough mess, Grant, and that downward spiral into that sort of anarcho-Randian chaos that you've described and observed rightly in Somalia is on our doorstep. You know, I used to think that maybe 350, 500 years down the road, if you could build a time machine, you could go forward and you would see a Balkanized North American continent. You know, with the Southeast and the Northeast and the Midwest and the West Coast, you know, all being separate nations. But I used to think that was 300, 500 years down the road. I'm not sure that it's not 100 years down the road or 75. You know, this is stuff now, Grant, that because of what was done in 8 short years of time, may be something that my grandchildren will have to contend with.
I think that's certainly the case, although I actually would contend it's more like 20 years. I see it as coming to that, and I think going to thwart, and I'll tell you something, that clearly it seems the intended ambition of many players to achieve simply that. Now, I've kind of read the beads of some of these people, and it occurs to me, my opinion, okay, that they would be perfectly comfortable as a Christo-fascist caliphate, basically, or a fiefdom someplace, as the vassal of some foreign lord. And they would rather achieve that than work on and develop the excellence in civic structure, continuity, cohesion, and those other things. It seems their priorities are so unprincipled and selfish, and they are not about keeping it united. You see what I mean? This is what I see.
Yes.
They're voted.
Yeah, and the point of that is that if it's 20 years time, Grant, then we get to contend with it at the most vulnerable state of our lives. You know, 20 years for me, I'm retirement age.
Yeah, I'll probably be swinging my oxygen bottle at people.
Yeah.
You know, that's basically probably what I'm going to be reduced to.
And
I see it coming. You know, but here's the thing. The things like the Crash Course, things like the Transition Town Initiative that started out of Ireland, I think those represent the best force of stability that we're ever going to get in this short window. Because what they do, they don't talk about grand theories. They don't come to you with a pre-digested formula. They place the responsibility on the community to figure it stuff out, and there are others to help you. So immediately, it is all about local interests, the basics. It is about relieving desperation within that locality. And we're looking for a relief of desperation in the aggregate of a population. It uses local resources. It encourages people to think and be resourceful, to rely upon each other, to be cohesive, but not under an authority. Simply as a community, a completely different focus than the crystal fascist moment.
Absolutely. And, you know, you go to the very heart of our buddy Kate's frequent query. You know, she says she has no patience for basically the politics is sport that I was talking about earlier. She says, you know, her focus is more, you know, where's your beans and how much beans do you have? Where's your rice? And how much rice do you have? Do you have clean, potable drinking water? And that's drawing that focus back to that community focus that you're talking about. Because, and you know, this is not me saying, you know, go out and buy freeze dried food, but there is that, you know, when it was pointed out. A brilliant piece on the Great Depression. It was over at democraticunderground.com, and our buddy Reverbo sent it along, and he said, "I hope this doesn't come true," but me too. But it was a stunning explanation of, and the thesis was why the next Great Depression is going to be a heck of a lot worse than the one we had was. And one of the points is that with that Great Depression, we had an idled manufacturing base that could be unidled and put back into service. That doesn't exist. The other part of it is that a significant portion of the American people, although broke, lived in the country and could at least raise enough of a garden to feed themselves.
Correct.
Those are both gone.
Well, that's why we're trying to bring... That's why I... got involved with a local group here in Portland, Oregon, a transition group, and it a lot of it's about carbon emissions and this kind of thing. On there's many facets, of course, but for me, it's about, well, what's, not only are we saving, you know, carbon emissions, but we have clean local sources of food. We've got clean, I mean, we're extremely fortunate in this city that we have pristine water. We're one of the only cities in the country where you can take tap water and put it into your battery and it won't foul your cell.
Wow.
Yeah, baby. But we've got a group out of Chicago using the EPA to come own our water supply or bugger with it. They're basically trying to steal the watch out of your pot back to you. 8 times the price. Yeah.
So you know, you remind me, and
there are these street fights coming.
Yeah, and you're gonna have to look, and that's the thing, the transformative street fights. Yeah, there's important stuff happening on the national level. Look at healthcare, but the stuff that and I think the other side probably understands it better than our side does, Grant, is that the transformative stuff is the stuff that happens at the local level. Just by example, you talk about, you know, street fights coming. Here in about 2 weeks, I get to go to the polls. I'm going to do my early voting tomorrow because I don't know if I'll be here or not. But we've got a school levy coming.
Uh-huh.
And if this levy passes, and you can go and find a map of Fayette County, West Virginia, you can see what's at stake.
All right.
If that school levy passes, all of my children will wind up going to high school 15 to 20 miles away. And that's everybody on this side of the New River, not just my family. It will represent the cancellation of this side of the river's communities' values as communities. And of course, you know, sad to say, they've got labor, the school board has labor on its side because there's lots of jobs in building the school. Because it's going to be a Franken school. It's going to be a huge thing. And they've made all these promises. Oh, well, my God, we're going to have so much space and so many teachers. My God, we're going to teach Linear B to fourth graders. You know, we'll have them study in advanced light in sixth grade. And you know, all those, and of course, none of these promises will be kept. And it means that nobody on my side of the river, you know, I love my son's participation in athletics, not because I'm living through him, but because it gives me an opportunity to do what a father should do, and that is help him maximize the talents and gifts and skills that he has, whether they be intellectual or physical or creative, you know.
And rejoice in the progression, of course.
Absolutely. Well, that doesn't happen, because you know what? Football practice lets out at, you know, 6 p.m., and there's no bus. And Mama and Daddy on the north side of the New River are mostly too poor to go and pick up Junior after football practice 5 days a week, 15 miles away, 30 miles round trip. And it will literally choke my community to death, what's left of it. And so we're busting our asses to try and stop it. Because, you know, in these little rural areas, and I'm sure in rural Oregon or rural Washington or rural anywhere, you know, God knows, rural Texas, rural Alabama, the community revolves around the community school. It's the common theme that everybody has. We all went to school together. If you graduated in 1963 or 1973, that's still your local school. And the move here in Appalachia is to take those away from us and depopulate this area so that the community will die on the vine, and then some coal company can come in and say, well, you know, nobody lives there. We might as well blow up their mountains. You're absolutely right, Grant. You know, these are fights. Yeah, they're street fights. And somehow or another, I got to travel. There's so many places on planet Earth I have to see. You know, our buddy David in Tennessee was a resident of Portland for a long time, and he's told me so many times, you just got to get out there and see it. You just got to get out there and see it.
Oh, yeah, Bob. I mean, if there's anything we can do along the way, and, you know, some private conversations to help you do that, I'd certainly be interested in that.
Well, you know,
the greater length of the Cascades are beautiful. We've got some lava monuments down south here.
And well, you know, look, where did Tom Hartman start broadcasting? Somewhere in New England, right? He didn't seem to have any problem moving to the Great Northwest.
No, not at all.
Well, maybe who knows? Maybe that station out there needs a hillbilly. Y'all can always feel free to call and ask.
Exactly. Yeah, I've been thinking about this quite a bit, and I would like to find a way to do the best of what liberal radio wants to do, but do it in a completely kind of way. And I'm not from the business, so I can't quite get my head around it. Okay, but one of the things I hear is that there's a lot of lone players, but there's no way for them, and there seems to be a disinclination sometimes to help each other and leverage each other's strength. Yeah. Then you've got the question of, well, even if you get your incentive structure right, are you going to self-censor when you take someone's money to keep your operation going?
That's
a question that I haven't heard anybody really give me.
Well, the self-censorship issue, Grant, is an absolute within the commercial structure. If you're taking Ben and Jerry's money, let's say, I mean, come on, it's ice cream. How can you get mad about ice cream? I'm using Ben and Jerry as an example because I can't think of anything they're doing that pisses me off. no recombinant bovine growth hormone in the milk that they use for their ice cream. No Guar, I don't know, maybe they do have Guar gum and locust bean gum. I'm not sure.
I don't think so. They're pretty scrupulous.
But anyway, sooner or later, if let's say, you know, and there's, okay, I know what, there's been labor stuff. There's been labor stuff. You know, if there's a labor action or a labor dispute at Ben and Jerry's, now Ben and Jerry's is writing my paycheck with their advertising. But my fundamental inclination is always to stand with the workers. Now, because they're writing that paycheck, I'm in a pickle. Because my morals are now up against my wallet. And that's where that quote comes in about it's mighty hard to get a man to understand something when his paycheck depends on him not understanding it. Because at that point, some portion of me would look at the workers and say, you know, why can't you people just get along? And you know, that's the quandary I've got over the school levy here in Fayette County. I'm as pro-labor as the day is long. But there's a lot of union workers out there that are actively engaged in lobbying to kill my community. Now, how am I supposed to feel about that? I don't take too kindly to it.
No.
But I also understand they need the work. And it goes back to what Kevin mentioned earlier in the show. Hey, looky, we've got them divided again.
Well, that's sort of why what I was trying to pursue, sort of hastily in the background, in a private conversations with a certain mutual friend or mutual acquaintance.
Yeah.
I've been looking to pursue this because I think the strategy you outlined is a good one. I think it's worth pursuing. And incidentally, I'm gathering information right now about what might be possible. I want a green infrastructure, and I want a green industrial base. There is no doubt in the talent. We have everything that we need, except a group of investors lined up to actually make it happen. That's the part.
And that's the rub. And where you're talking about radio, or media, the rub comes in the form of the question. What needs to be done is that there needs to be some sort of nonprofit model whereby people can do the right thing and you don't have to run up against that commercial conundrum. Because the minute that somebody writes you the check, you've self-censored. Because even if it doesn't tangentially even if it doesn't directly impact your thoughts, it will do so tangentially.
Indeed.
Well, Grant, we've run right up against it. Wonderful conversation. I'm glad you called in.
Yes, I'm glad as well. I enjoyed our conversation.
And we will continue to pursue these things. Thank you very much.
Indeed. Take care.
All right. Take care, Grant. Bye now.
Bye.
Calling from Oregon in the Portland area, that is our buddy Grant. Let's see. One more call to try to get in. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Lee in Austin.
Hey, what's up, Lee?
I got a quick question for you. I heard a thing. Are you hip to the Justice Act that Feingold's sponsoring right now?
Haven't learned about it, but probably sounds like I oughta.
It's about the whole sneak and peek. You know, it's one of those things, like when you have the drug war and they go, well, it's, you'd have the drug war, so they'd impose those laws, or they'd dump the RICO thing on for conspiracy. You know, the mob's kind of broken, you know, but they never really, you know, they just say they dial it back kind of thing. But it's really like they're moving the goalposts around, if you know what I mean.
I do know.
And they were talking about that sneak and peek is never good for terrorism. You know, I mean that, you know, that the whole thing is it's going to be used for criminal stuff. You know, so instead of them rolling it back, why aren't they actually getting out there and saying something like, you know, well, for in use of terrorism only. Does that make sense? Am I saying it right?
Yeah, you are. In other words, to limit it to terrorism applications.
Exactly. But instead, they're just like, well, we'll roll it back. But they're not going to do that. You know what I mean? They're not going to limit it to terrorism things. All they ever have to do is go and put one sentence and go, so the Patriot Act when it comes to terrorism.
Augustus, throughout his reign as Caesar, every couple of years, he promised that he would restore the Republic. Just as soon just as soon as we've taken care of this last little barbarian horde problem, I'm going to restore the republic.
Yeah, so again, it just feels like we're being, you know, sold down the river, whatever it is. And one last quick thing, I'll let you go. But you know that case you guys love quoting, the 1866 Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific?
Yes.
Do you know who the Chief Justice was on that case?
Oh, God, I used to. Tell me, help me.
Morrison R. Bones, class of 1836.
Okay, say the name again. It got kind of garbled.
Sorry, Morrison R. Waite, W-A-I-T-E. And he was Skull and Bones in class, in like 1836.
Why am I not surprised? You know, you can't get anything past that crowd.
But it's, you know, tinfoil hat stuff, so, you know, I'll just let it go at that.
Yeah, right.
Well, look, you have a great week. I just wanted to mention that thing about the Justice Act. And, oh, by the way, three more 9/11 workers. I found this on, I think, New York Daily, NY Daily, maybe. Three more 9/11 first responders died in 5 days or so this week.
Oh, Jesus.
And and they mentioned in that story, I think I shot Sue a link, mentioned in that story that there's, you know, there's a bill that's been sitting on Congress's desk forever about getting help to the health and restitution or whatever, recompensation or whatever they called it, to the first responders.
Well, I remember when the Bush administration wanted to cut funding to New York because they were afraid that it was going to go to too many, there was going to be too much workers' comp out of it.
Yeah, the bill that's sitting around, hold on, I've got it right here, and I'll let you go. It's called the James Zadroga 9/11 Health and Compensation Act, named after an NYPD detective who died from his post-9/11 ailments. But anyway, it's the end of the show, so I will let you go. You have a wonderful time. And
Well, Lee, thanks so much for calling in, and I really do appreciate your patience, and we'll talk longer next time.
Yes, sir.
All right. Bye now.
See ya.
And that is how, in a matter of what seems like bare minutes, 3 hours go by. Thanks, everybody, for getting the week off to a great start. Back tomorrow night, same bat time, same bat channel. You know how to do it. I hope you'll be here, because I will. And join us then. Thanks to John Fox. Thanks to Peter Godbold, who continues to recover and continues to receive all our best wishes. Thanks to Ben Birch. And best wishes to Katie Birch, who is a wonderful, wonderful human being and is getting better after an illness. We love you, Katie. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. Big meeting tomorrow night. We'll probably wind up talking about it on Wednesday. Coal River Mountain Watch is the hardest working, bravest people I know. And they're always proving why. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you.
Conversation cussing and discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy!
Thank God it's Monday. It is I think we may have a new feature here. I'm not sure. I think we may have a new feature. I'm thinking of calling this, and tell me what you think, and don't hold back. Don't be afraid of your feelings. I'm thinking of calling this Moran Monday. How do you like that? Moran Monday. I don't know if we had a really good girl singer, there might be even a parody in the works. Who was it? The Bangles, Manic Monday. What was that? Susanna Hoffs was the lead singer or something. Have I got that right? And no, Moran Monday, just another Moran Monday. That kind of thing. And what do I mean by that? Well, I thought we would look at some Moran conduct. In this particular instance, Moran conduct coming from the for-profit media. You know, the Martini and Morphine set. That crowd of paid shills in Washington, D.C., who breathlessly have fits over things the Obama administration does, they never somehow found a way to have fits about when the Bush administration was doing it. And, you know, it's there and it's closer to home, too. But I don't know, that seemed like it might be appropriate. Moran Monday. And, of course, I think if you're going to have a Moran Monday, you just can't do it. You simply cannot do it without dealing with Chicken Noodle News's Howie Kurtz. And in this particular instance, the breathless pearl clutching coverage of Ms. Dunn's comments about, you know, reality. The fact that Fox News is a propaganda arm of the Republican Party. It just is. How is it not? You know how I know the truth of this? Because a few minutes ago, I saw the rodeo clown, Lonesome Rhodes. They're on that self-same Fox network, bloviating. And breathlessly, we got to, I don't know, maybe we need a campaign to start sending pearls to Glenn Beck so that he can clutch at them. Because he took that story, and you know what I'm talking about, the one where Anita Dunn, White House Communications Director, showed up on Sunday and said, well, you know, it's not like Fox is a real news organization like CNN or anything. They're a right-wing propaganda arm of the Republican Party. Washington, inside Washington, was shocked. They were shocked. They couldn't believe that someone would say something like that. How incivil! I'm clutching for them. I don't even have pearls, and I'm clutching for my pearls here. It was too much to contemplate. You know what I'm talking about, of course. I'm certain that you do. You can't not. In case you're wondering,
Well, I can help with that. We have audio, and we also have a story breaking today about a new report coming out from, lo and behold, the insurance industry. We just got the ransom note. Really, how is this not a ransom note? We did. We just got the ransom note. If you go through with this reform thing, we're going to jack your prices up 111%. How's that? I mean, that's sort of the accounting equivalent of mailing us the tip end of somebody's finger. And seeing as how you've lost the tip end of your finger, putting that sucker back's a pre-existing condition. And you're not covered, America. You're not covered. How do you like that? Take that. Yeah, don't fool with us. Yeah. No, a report came out today. Now, never mind the fact that the methodology is extremely spotty. And not exactly anything you would call a methodology at all. But Representative Anthony Winder of New York got it right on the first try. He looked at this report, and he said, you know, if you have the healthcare industry complaining that we're going to raise costs because of these charges, it is them putting us on notice that we haven't put enough cost containment in the bill. You know, the healthcare industry themselves is putting out a whole report saying that. That should be a tell to the Baucus team that, you know what, maybe it's time for them to go back and revisit the public option. In a strange way, and look, obviously they didn't mean this, the health insurance lobby today fired the most important salvo in weeks for the public option because they've said, as clear as day, left to their own devices, according to their own number crunchers, they're going to raise rates 111%. You know, I think if we were, I think if healthcare was run by the mob, we'd probably have a little bit better business dealings here. I just saying. Oh, and by the way, this story about this that I'm looking at, and I know I'm commenting on a photograph now. This is the dancing about architecture part of the program. But I'm looking at a photograph of Karen Ignagni?